Inbox 1 by Annie D. Read by Cookie Mom 6067. Chapter 1, BD-01432. Tony sits up and blinks himself awake. Though still partially asleep, his brain's whirring through a half-baked list of things that he needs to get to, some of which are real and some of which are dream-induced and will be forgotten within the next half hour. He thinks of coffee, security systems, and a brilliant design for the Iron Man rocket boots that will reduce drag. He yawns and scratches his chin. Jarvis.
Good morning, sir, Jarvis says. The highlights?
Yeah, hit me. Tony makes his way to the bathroom while Jarvis goes through the high points of what the world has been up to while he was asleep. A lot of it is the same old, though some of it is interesting enough that he might come back to it later. Most important is it sounds like there's nothing that needs immediate firefighting, be it from Tony Stark or Iron Man. Jarvis has this part of the routine down practically to a science, timing it such that the digest winds up just as Tony's patting his face with aftershave.
Messages? Tony asks.
Miss Potts and the one, sir. Assuming, that is, that we are ignoring the rest of your overflowing inbox.
Tony grins.
Indeed we are. Send them straight to the lab. We're having a working breakfast.
Very good, sir.
In a post-Iron Man world, Tony's habits have changed. Not all of them, of course. Reinvention only goes so far, and coffee remains the lifeblood of his creativity. But as Rhodey, Pepper, and Happy can attest to, these days there's less of the gallivanting, glitz-chasing, and arbitrary purchases of things that aren't technically for sale. Instead, Tony's now neck-deep in the wild world of superheroing, whatever that means, with its near-misses, boundary-pushing, and long hours looking at a bottom line that only he seems able to see. But there's another habit that's new. As Tony sits at his workbench, one hand feeding himself a ham sandwich, and the other hand setting the panoramic display alight, he indulges in that habit. Two screens are filled with the schematic he was working on yesterday, but one screen is filled with his inboxes, with one particular window at the top right, where he can see it clearer than the others clamoring for his attention. This window contains messages tied to an email address that cannot be found anywhere in what counts as Tony's official communication channels. It also contains messages from a single person who's identifiable only, in both the computer and to Tony himself, as BD-01432. Thank you for the link, though I'd describe it as helpful as much as it is baffling, because tonally I can't see any difference between these articles and the ones you shared from that speculative fiction website. Are we supposed to just know these things? I almost typed a question on whether people really have enough space in their heads for all these nuances and never-ending interconnecting references, but I think I've already used up this month's quota of extra existential questions. The historical archive link you gave was much more fascinating. I think the old designs were far more eye-catching. Tony gasps, offended for all of 2 seconds before he realizes that BD-01432 is teasing him. So instead of existential, I will ask something more relevant. How long before the internet is advanced enough to send information in smells and tastes? Or is the internet already advanced to this stage, and I've missed it? And if so, how does it work? I think having such a technology would reduce a lot of fighting I've seen on websites about which recipes are more accurate to the originals. Come to think of it, that would probably make the fighting worse, won't it? If we can send smells and tastes over the internet, it'd make restaurant reviews more interesting, too. People might decide where to go based on that entirely. T-I-L, that memory is tied very strongly to our sense of smell. Tony doesn't read the whole message in one go. He comes back to it in fits and starts through the late morning and during breaks between other things that he's doing. Though as he reads it, he tags the message with notes that he eventually uses to compose a reply.
As hard as I wish it, there's no normal distribution, as in the statistical definition, of social knowledge. But the trick is to know just enough and fake your way through the rest of it. I guarantee you that other people know less than you, though they might not realize it. People don't know what they don't know. So you're already a step up, really. Tony pauses here to check what's the latest in the industry and contemplates for a hot second what the world would be like if digital smells could be employed as biological warfare. How would that even be delivered? That sounds terrible. But on the flip side, there are no laws about it yet, so something to think about, maybe. About the smell thing, some basic kinds of smell and taste have been coded, but the challenge is in recreating them down the information line. Imagine remote taste testing. Yes, I meant the culinary kind, but did I only mean that? You'll never know. The reply gets saved in his drafts while Tony goes out for a flight test and saves a cruise ship off Hawaii while he's at it. After that, he changes one suit for another and spends the afternoon with Pepper and a disgruntled procurement team, during which they wrangle long-term contracts and supply chain issues. Later, after Happy's dumped Tony back at the house, he traipses upstairs and into the deepest recesses of his closet. After about half an hour of rummaging around and laughing, when he finds something, he takes his treasure back down to the workshop where he resumes typing the draft. Thanks to you, I went hunting for anything old I had lying around. Managed to find a jacket I thought I threw out years ago. Put my face into it and took a deep breath. And swear to God, I full-on hallucinated myself into being young and stupid again. There's another pause here, while Tony lets his eye drift over to pieces of the Mark V suit. Each generation of armor seems to be coming together faster than the last one, yet he's still finding a long list of shortcomings of each. The world's catching up, too. Regardless of how Tony's been telling people that Vanco was a one-off, there will be others, and Tony's current advantage lies mainly in his resources at hand, both physical and mental. BD-01432 doesn't know that about Iron Man, or even that Tony is, well, Tony Stark. They're just pixels on a screen to each other, which has been the case since they started exchanging messages a few months ago. But that's the reason why Tony keeps reading and replying. It's a low-stakes conversation with someone who doesn't want anything from him except the time and thoughts that Tony's willing to share with him. Iron Man and SI may command the greatest portion of Tony's attention, but here is a small corner of the world that Tony can let his mind retreat to at its own pace, where there's no threat of deadlines simmering behind each message. Tony never meant or expected for this conversation to go for as long as it has, not after that first message, where he explained to the poor guy that the message box was not a search bar. But solving BD-01432's computer problems, that first time, got BD-01432 into a rant that still cracks Tony up to think about, and Tony couldn't help but expand BD-01432's vocabulary to include such words as accessibility and algorithm before going into his own rants on trends in technology and the internet that are more dangerous than people realize. BD-01432 found all of that fascinating and responded with more questions that ballooned on from there. There's also the fact BD-01432 is funny and charming in his own way, and an utter delight whenever he shares things with Tony as he discovers them. Better yet, there's a directness in his questions and communication style that is a goddamn breath of fresh air in the midst of all the complexity that is the rest of Tony's reality. In chatting with him, Tony is also free to go on tangents of his own in the safety of knowing that BD-01432 can't use them against him. He types out, "Not at all a fan of becoming stupid like that again. But it might be nice to have a couple of those years back, use them better, that kind of thing. And I'm saying that as someone who likes racing against the world for how fast it's going these days. A kind of hypocrisy. I've been told I have a bad relationship with wastage, though it hadn't occurred to me until lately how time wastage counts too. Anyway, I put the jacket smell into a rough code, far from accurate, but this is what it might look like. Attachment, jacket.txt. Tony hits send, then turns his attention to the rest of his projects, followed by dinner. Wherever BD-01432 may physically be, he keeps hours almost as odd as Tony's, which makes the timing of his replies unpredictable. Sometimes whole days may go without a reply, and sometimes they arrive within a few hours. Today, Tony gets a reply just as he's about to close up shop in the late night, early morning. Tony has it sent to his phone so he can read it while he's going upstairs. I think all the time about what I'd do if I got a couple of my early years back. More than is healthy, I'm pretty sure. But from the way it sounds with you, it's not so much that you want those specific years back, but you want more time period, so you can do everything you want to do. My days aren't filled like that at all, but it's been getting better. So please keep the recommendations coming, with the caveat that I'll probably ignore most of them. Tony laughs. I can't code the smell of this ravioli. Attachment, img0023.jpg. But please be assured that it is excellent. I picked an eatery at random, did not look at any of its online reviews beforehand at all, and enjoyed the meal more than I thought I would. The cream is especially great. The photo is blurry on purpose, because this adds to its charm, and it's not, because I still feel foolish taking photos of food in a public space. No one's asked if I'm a food critic or influencer, so that's one unnecessary fear that I can lay to rest. I sketched a portion of your jacket coat on this napkin. Maybe this has a better chance of going viral than a poorly lit photo of food. Attachment, img0025jpg. Tony decides to reply tomorrow, but he adds a tag to the message draft to remind himself later. Beautiful sketch. Print it. Chapter 2. Captain America. Tony's heard the rumors, of course. There'd been sightings here and there over the past few months, and more than a few of those sightings had a whiff of S.H.I.E.L.D. about them. But Tony wasn't about to go looking any deeper if he didn't have to, when chances were likely S.H.I.E.L.D. already had a finger on that pie. What was more likely? That Captain America's finally been found, and even more miraculously that he's still alive and is back in the field? Or that Fury's gone and found another schmuck who can fit into that dusty old uniform and has arranged for that to happen for the sake of giving his project both a front man and the supposed legitimacy of a legacy? Tony isn't expecting that first one, but that is what he gets when he's tracking a stolen crate of old SI prototypes being transported up to Tacoma. He gets to the warehouse, makes his entrance, repulsors blazing, of course, and is maybe 5 minutes away from getting a name and location out of the thieving goons when it all goes to hell. "This is you," one of the thieves says, turning his gun on one of their own. "You led him right to us." "No, that's not..." The accused gives up and starts running, with one hand to his ear as he says, "Cover's blown. Go, go, go." People start firing. Tony rises into the air defensively, and a window breaks as someone wearing what looks like S.H.I.E.L.D.-issue body armor rappels into the warehouse. "What the hell? Jarvis, get me their frequency." It takes maybe 2 seconds to get patched into their frequency, and Tony repeats with vehement feeling, "What the hell? Fury, is this you?" "Stark," comes a male voice that is definitely not Fury. "We need you to stand down." "Stand... are you kidding me?" Tony exclaims. "We need to get to them before they wipe their drives," says a voice that is almost definitely Natasha Romanoff. "Clint, I've got you covered." Tony tunes out their chatter, trusting Jarvis to boost the volume if there's anything that needs his attention. His eye is on the one guy who looked like he was about to spill, and in tracking him, Tony carefully weaves his way around the crates and shelves. But there are other people in the building now, some of them firing projectile weapons, and the Iron Man suit isn't at its best in closed quarters. Tony curses its poor maneuverability at corners, and curses again when someone gets bodily thrown in the air right in front of him. "Damn it!" Tony makes a vector change, which comes at the cost of him nearly flying straight into a wall. He turns, trying to regain his balance midair, and that's when a bogey alarm flashes across the hub. It's the goddamn vibranium shield. The suit immediately tries to calculate the shield's trajectory as it bounces off a beam, but there's a mistake in Tony's programming somewhere. That's the only explanation for how, instead of traveling safely overhead, the shield hits the suit's shoulder blade stabilizer with a clang of metal on metal that reverberates all the way through Tony's body. Tony falls, regains height, then sways to one side and bumps into crates that clatter and fall. When the lower ancillary stabilizer finally kicks in to compensate, he sends a repulsor blast to the door in the hopes of blocking it. But the guy he was tracking makes it out. "Fuck!" Tony exclaims. More beams give way, blocking his exit. The warehouse has apparently decided that it's had enough of this bullshit. The landing Tony makes isn't one of his best. Anger makes his heart beat fast against the arc reactor, and he stands up to the suit's full height, just as Captain America, in blue and white, but no red, comes jogging towards him. "Stark," the captain says, "I'm sorry, I didn't mean to hit you. You saw me flying there." The helmet's faceplate pops open, so there's no filter between Tony's yelling and Tony's target. "I am bright red and literally lit up. Don't tell me you couldn't fucking see me." Captain America blinks inside his cowl, surprised but recovering quickly. "I did see you, but..." "And you let him get away," Tony exclaims. "He was right there, and you just..." "We're not tracking one person," Captain America says. "We've been following their whole operation. They have massive connections, and frankly, you interrupted just as we were..." "I don't believe this." Tony looks from the captain to the rest of the little shield crew, where one of them is tying down the single soul goon they were able to capture alive. There's a familiar flash of red when another shield agent turns, and Tony snaps, "Romanoff, you with him?" Romanoff looks up from the computer device she's peeled apart. "Not a gatecrasher, if that's what you're asking." She waves the device at him. "You know about these? How's it connected to SI? "Oh, no," Tony says. "You don't get to ask me for anything. You rejected me, remember? I'm a free agent." He expects a reply from Romanoff, but it's Captain America who speaks, with the easy confidence of a man used to being listened to. "I thought you were the opposite of free. Biggest price tag is what I heard." Tony turns to meet the captain's gaze. This time Tony looks properly, taking in the height and breadth of the man, the very military stance with which he stands, and his easy hefting of the vibranium shield, as though it's a natural extension of his arm, a man not on the verge of battle, but out of cautious rest, alert and powerful, and knowing that he looks every inch of it. He doesn't flinch at Tony's wary stare, either. Tony will give him that. Tony draws, "The biggest price tag of all, yes. Not only that, but sometimes I even want people to say please." "Right," the captain says, his tone dry as dust. "So we're not going to get your cooperation on this case? What's in it for me? What's in..." The captain sighs. "We need to stop these people. They're dangerous." "Oh, really?" Tony says. "I didn't know that. I'm just here to order takeout." "Tony," Romanoff says, stepping forward. Tony waves her back, not in the mood for conciliatory gestures. He had better not be the actual Captain America, because if he is, then that legendary aim is rather off. "It really is him," Romanoff says. "FedEx right from the 40s? Tony brings his chin up and turns back to the captain, who has a hand set impatiently at his hip. "Well, then, I'm afraid to inform you that your legendary aim is slightly off. I guess that's something else that people exaggerated, huh?" Captain America pushes his helmet up to his brow, and there he is, Captain Steve Rogers. Patriotic wet dream enshrined in old stylized posters that used to line Howard's study. For a second, Tony feels like he's 5 years old, and carefully turning the pages of Mint Comics that he's not supposed to be touching at all. But the moment passes and he's standing in front of a man who's human enough to be sweating, scowling, and sporting a bruise across his jaw. Captain Rogers says, I'm starting to think my aim was dead on. One of the S.H.I.E.L.D. agents inhales sharply. The one named Clint, maybe.
Nice, Tony says. I can sue you for that. No, I'll sue Fury. Give him some paperwork to shuffle around. He'll appreciate that, right?
Stark, Romanoff says.
No, you don't get to work me, Tony says, kicking off his rocket boots and rising in the air. Good luck with cleanup, champs.
One of the broken windows is taken as a convenient exit, and in no time, Tony's soaring high above the area, rising higher and higher towards the cloud line. Adrenaline keeps him company almost the whole way back, during which he slowly and methodically recognizes the implications of actual Captain Rogers being back from the dead. There's the tragedy of Howard's failed years of searching, when there actually was something to be found. The danger of a living sample of working super serum back in existence with additional proof of its effect on human resilience and longevity. The recalibration that the captain's existence must mean for Fury's S.H.I.E.L.D. capabilities and whatever plans he has for the Avengers reality show. Actual Captain America is back from the dead, and he had to ruin Tony's day. Well, technically it was S.H.I.E.L.D. who ruined Tony's day, but S.H.I.E.L.D.'s done that before. Captain America gets to be a shiny new target this time. It's good to have a new target to blame, too, now that he's pretty much wasted the last couple of days arranging the bait to catch these thieves. Now that that's ruined, he'll have to talk to Pepper and close up the security gaps. The next couple of days are going to be drudgery after drudgery that he can't entirely delegate without causing a shitstorm with SI's stakeholders. Once he arrives home, Tony gives in to the impulse of having an extra-large order of pizza sent to the house. The intention is to stuff himself and crash, but he remembers that he received a message from BD-01432 this morning. Before he headed out, he opens it on his phone and reads as he starts to leave the workshop. Imagine my surprise that I might have to correct you on something. I looked up the USAF space program, and their space planes did breach the technical edge of space. So who's to say what might have happened if segmentation and politics were slightly different, for good or otherwise? Here's a thought exercise for the militarization of space. What do you think? TIL, that it has been 4 decades since the last human being stepped on the moon. Seems a shame, really. Oh, shit, Tony gasps. The message goes on for a couple more paragraphs, too, as BD-01432 gets into one of Tony's favorite topics. I am not wrong, though. Wait, am I? Tony's dragging steps turn into an excited bounding up the stairs. He quickly starts opening tabs to find specific articles, glad for the invitation to go on tangents about space-faring rockets while stuffing his face with pizza, which is a great way to close out an otherwise wash of a day. You big nerd, Tony says fondly.
Chapter 3. Iron Man. Wait, Rhodey says, and in his excitement, sloshing his cup of coffee dangerously to one side, Captain America, Captain America? The one and only, apparently, Tony says. Guess Fury found exactly what he needed. Rhodey hums thoughtfully.
They're having brunch on the balcony of the Malibu house, with Rhodey down to his polo shirt thanks to the day's warm weather. It's actually a really nice day in general, to the point that Tony wasn't in the mood to talk about the botched trail from 2 days ago. But of course, Rhodey had to bring it up, and Tony had to deflect from the fact that his brilliant idea got squandered by focusing on his most important of tidbits.
You probably want to check that out, though, Rhodey says.
What am I talking about? You already are. He narrows his eyes. If you invited me over to find out what I know...
Please, Tony scoffs. If I was going to milk you for intel, I would have told you up front.
That's a relief. Rhodey shakes his head.
Captain America. Surprised that Fury didn't set up a proper introduction to make up for the botched one, considering Howard's everything.
Right, Rhodey grins, happy to not point out that Tony's squirming in his seat.
Great day out, though. Want to take one of the cars out?
Yes, I was thinking the JAG, but you know how I feel about working in teams, Tony whines. It's slow, it's drama, it's layers upon layers of red tape to get anything done. Did I mention slow? I'm not saying that you should work with them, just that this is a connection you have and you should use it. A connection? Fury isn't a connection. He is, though. Ugh. Rhodey nods sympathetically. How about the Lexus? Fine, Tony grumps. Yes, you can drive. Through the rest of brunch, Rhodey walks Tony through a reply to Maria Hill's email, reviving an invitation that Tony's been procrastinating on for so long that might have been rescinded by now. They find a compromise in tone, where Tony still gets to sound like he's giving in and doing them a favor, yet not offensive enough that Fury will ignore him. After that, Rhodey excuses himself to the washroom, leaving Tony free to read BD01432's latest missive, still fresh in his other inbox. I'm sorry that your recent project fell through, though I might be feeling sorrier about how you think it's a good idea to offer valid currency for one of my sketches. I can't say I've ever had any of my drawings described as a pick-me-up purchase before, yet it seems I can't turn you down. So, here's something I put together over the weekend. Attachment, emerald03.jpg. You can send my payment to this charity. Smiley face, link. I don't need any details, but if you want to unburden yourself of anything, I'm perfectly happy to read it and be confused at the lack of context. If you need a lead in to get started, I'll offer something of my own first. I feel comforted when you describe how your days are so busy, a vicarious feeling, as though I'm being productive by simply reading your messages. My world feels like a long stretch of nothing sometimes, with only small distractions here and there, since the old dreams I used to have are no longer relevant. Regardless, I'm sharing another sketch with you free of charge. Did I mention that I bought some watercolors? I have, and I'm terrible at using them, but I like how the color bleeds. Attachment, whoops.jpg. You, mister, are too smooth for your own good, Tony says. The first drawing is a beautiful charcoal depiction of a medieval perpetual machine, which isn't something that Tony would have thought of when he asked BD01432 to draw something more complicated than his usual life sketches. It's hard to tell whether BD01432 drew it from life or a photo, but it feels alive, in the way that interesting machines do. Tony quickly starts a new draft to catch his thoughts while they're fresh. Old dreams may be irrelevant, yet there's always space for new ones. But that's easier said than done. As if you can press a button on a vending machine and get a new goal, tailor-made just for you, piping hot. Yum. Maybe the stork messed up and I got your new dreams by accident. I know I wasn't looking for any, but my life got a major upheaval recently, as in I'm kind of sort of turning over a new leaf while still figuring out how different that new leaf could be from the old leaf. And by the way, a lot of people still think I'm on the old leaf, but just with a fresh coat of paint, and sometimes I think that might be true. If I could carve out a little piece of this overwhelming pie and send it to you, I would. Please don't tell me, Rhodey says at Tony's shoulder, making him jump what feels like 2 feet in the air, that you're still writing to your catfish. I've already had one emergency heart surgery this past year. Thanks, Tony gasps, a hand at his chest. Hey, but seriously, Rhodey raises an eyebrow when Tony saves the draft and shoves his phone into his back pocket. Is it the same guy? You have nothing to be jealous about, Tony says solemnly. Rhodey rolls his eyes. And you better not be hitting on an old man who's just trying to understand the internet. Just for that, I'm downgrading your car privileges, Tony says. You know what? Worth it. And don't call him old, Tony says, trailing after Rhodey as he heads for the garage. He's a late learner who's trying his best. Oh my God, Rhodey mutters. The next day, Tony follows up on the email he sent to Hill. Specifically, this involves accepting their invitation to fly up to the helicarrier, during which Tony gleefully takes notes on design flaws that he's going to shove under Fury's nose at the most dramatic opportunity. They're expecting him, so he docks his suit in the hangar and makes his way up to the bridge, where Hill gives him an impressively perfunctory tour before hassling him towards a conference room. "As promised, I brought what I have," Tony says, twirling the USB stick between his fingers. "Might be useful, might not. Can I get a name in return?"
"Didn't know we were bartering," Hill says. "Vuri."
Tony turns as the man himself sweeps in, leather trench coat evidently tailored to give an illusion of billowing in non-existent wind. There's another man behind Fury, too, Rogers, though he's in a dress shirt and jacket instead of a tactical suit. The sight is subtly unsettling. Something about that face is familiar as the smell of old books in Howard and Maria's library, sitting under a modern haircut and complimented with a snazzy new shirt but a grandfather jacket that's at least one size too big. Tony has a sudden regret that he didn't put on something fancier than a Pink Floyd t-shirt, though at least he's wearing a blazer that actually fits.
"Stark, glad you could make it," Fury says with a nod.
"Steve Rogers, Tony Stark. Tony Stark, Steve Rogers. A mutual preceding of reputations, I expect."
"Yeah, we've..." Tony grimaces when Rogers takes a step towards him and busies his hands in his pockets before Rogers can ask for a handshake.
"Right, anyway. Name? Alias? Business card, maybe? Who's running this op? You, Cap?"
Rogers, to Tony's surprise, looks at Hill.
"No, not me. I'm just the muscle."
"Plenty of that, sure," Tony says, letting his eye drift to Rogers's biceps, which were apparently not exaggerated by his combat outfit. "Brains usually help, though."
Rogers' blue eyes go flinty, and there's a hint of a wry smile at the pull of his mouth.
"Or, it seems, a big suit of armor that's pretty much a gun."
"Are we being judgy now?" Tony says, unable to stop himself. It's like poking at a painting, a Mona Lisa even, in trying to get that implacable face to change. "I'm literally standing in a small flying city with... What can you do with this thing again?"
"Find Captain America, for starters," Fury says. "Not curious enough to ask, Stark."
"Maybe," Tony says. "Global warming, crack open an ice floe somewhere?"
"You're welcome to read the report." Fury opens his hand. "That for us?"
"Oh, come on, that's not an even trade," Tony says. Rogers huffs under his breath, which makes Tony look at him sharply.
"Why are you here? Why is he here?"
"I did not think it would be an issue," Fury says dryly.
"You know he hit me with the shield," Tony asks.
"One, I apologized," Rogers says. "And two, it didn't hit hard enough to cause serious damage. I've read the files. I know what kind of firepower you carry."
"Ah, good," Tony says. "So then we can dispense with the dick measuring. Save some time."
"Right," Rogers says. "What's the difference between Iron Man and any other vigilante off the street again?"
Tony lets his face stretch into a smile. $1 billion, that's what."
"One set of rules for the really rich, and another set for the rest of us, huh?" Rogers says.
Tony knows he should stop. He would know that even if he didn't notice the way Fury and Hill are exchanging exasperated looks. But everything about Captain Rogers is the muleta to Tony's irritated bull, a humorless authority figure in military garb, and one who was constantly used as an emotional bludgeon by Howard to boot. Tony can't stop.
"So, Soldier Barbie can learn," Tony says. "Good for you."
"Gentlemen," Fury says firmly. "Matter at hand, if you don't mind."
"I don't really need to be here," Rogers says.
"Actually, you do," Fury says. "If we can piece together another effective lead, I'd like both of you to follow it."
Tony expends zero effort to modify his facial expression. Roger seems like he's about to sigh, but then he squares up his shoulders and nods. Tony opens his mouth to comment on that, but thinks better of it when Fury's eye swivels towards him.
"Okay," Tony says. "Sure, why not?"
"Glad to hear it," Fury says.
To be fair, Tony works with people he can't stand all the time. It's not a preference, but sometimes it can't be helped when the risk-benefit plays out to his favor. Plus, Tony is very interested to learn about what S.H.I.E.L.D. has learned so far, including the identities of the other non-SI targets.
He can't immediately see how useful Captain Rogers will be for any of this data crunching, but that's another matter. It'll be fast, anyway, a few days tops, since S.H.I.E.L.D. is no more interested in having Tony around for long as it is the other way around. Although, Tony says, while at the corner of his eye he sees Roger's shoulders go up slightly, that means this is still a consultancy, isn't it? A friendly collaboration, Fury amends himself. A mutually beneficial collaboration, and I do mean mutual and beneficial. Can I look at your servers? Tony asks. Hill will walk you through what we have, Fury says. Tony rubs his hands together. Yay! Do I get an office on the helicarrier? You can have caps, Fury says, which makes Roger's chiseled face contort hilariously, until Fury adds, just a little humor to get things going. Let's go up to the lab. Hill, please call in Romanoff and Barton. Sure thing, Hill says. There's no need to delay, so they get right down to it. As a group, they spend the next few hours poring over maps and trade routes and invoices. It's even actually productive, albeit in fits and starts, as Tony peels apart the assumptions in group speak of Fury's little league team. Though a good thing about Romanoff and Barton, Clint, getting added to the mix, is that it makes for a decent buffer between Tony and the good captain, who is, Tony can freely admit this, very good at glowering professionally, as though he's thinking very deep thoughts. By the end of the day, there's no conclusions just yet, but some potential threads that they'll follow up on. The flight home is the perfect time for Tony to open the latest draft for BD-01432 that he'd started yesterday. With Jarvis keeping an eye on the sky, Tony dictates his thoughts in a typical ramble, with the text transcribed on the HUD as he speaks them. Where was I? Right, okay. Big world, lots of things, too many things. Start note to self. Do not send this without editing it first. End note to self. It's not that I don't enjoy what I'm doing with my life now. It feels right. Like that perfectly sized, perfectly shaved gear that slips right in, click, and makes everything fit together. Perfect. Beautiful. Ha, okay. Feel free to ignore everything else after this. Open square bracket, start, close square bracket. The point is, I know the whole thing about how we should do good things for their own sake instead of for the recognition, but sometimes, Roger Scal in particular makes him queasy. Authority figures in general, Tony can deal with and dismiss, but Captain America was, is, an icon of the time when the right thing to do was easy to see. Iron Man belongs to a murkier 21st century. Tony would vastly prefer a world where the suit wasn't necessary, but he needs to hold on to that for now while he works on everything else. He's a fucking adult. Captain America's disapproval shouldn't bother him. I need that recognition, that outside point of view. I know what I need to do, but there are moments where I wonder how I can possibly trust my judgment when I've done so many crappy things in the past without a second thought. Makes me second-guess myself. I've been plowing through, making my own calls sometimes against the advice of people I trust the most, but at the same time, I need validation that I'm doing the right thing. Where do you go looking for that? How do you go looking for that when so many people already believe I'm only doing this for attention? Open square bracket and close square bracket. Anyway, you are being productive reading my messages because you have a 100% approval rating from your audience, which is key. Here, I saw this article for a new, supposedly environmentally friendly terrestrial vehicle. Your blood pressure is going to have fun with this one. Start note to self. Add link to that sub-monstrosity here. End note to self. Later, when Tony arrives at home, he reads the draft through and tidies it up, but keeps the gist, because it's true and it feels good to have another human being read it, though BD-01432 will never know the context or how important it is to Tony. The next morning, there's a comfortably long reply from BD-01432, which opens with, "Sticking to your convictions can be a lonely path." Not always, but that's something I've found to be true even today. Honestly, I think the fact you're able to check in with yourself is the most important thing already. We both know that there are plenty of people in the world who don't bother with self-reflection at all. I don't always know the right thing to do either, But my mother used to tell me that no matter how big or how small an action we take in the world, it must do the least amount of harm, be it to ourselves or to others. Not that we can ever be sure what harm actually means, but I think it matters that we try our best. I wish that these kinds of answers could come easy, and sometimes I trick myself into thinking that it was easier in the past, but I don't think that's ever been true. It's just that we get better at seeing what harm looks like as we grow as people and understand how interconnected the world is. Even when looking back, sometimes we have to let ourselves believe that we've done the right thing, if only because there's no undoing that past. You can't undo your past either. And I believe that your actions will sooner or later speak for themselves. You write as if you're a star, a sun, burning bright and hot, so to warm the whole world. There's more that follows, but Tony puts his phone down for now. He's wide awake and warmed from the inside out, so he's going to savor the rest of the message over coffee and breakfast. And then he's going to draft a reply that's witty and classy and not at all a caps lock-ridden message wondering how BD-01432 can make kind, thoughtful words sound so goddamn sexy. Chapter 4, Cherry Red 32. This is what you miss when you don't get up early. Attachment Sunrise 04 JPEG. Happy to miss it, but here. Attachment Sunrise 04 plus edit.jpg. Now Stick Me is enjoying the sunrise with you, but is also 0.2 seconds away from having a nervous breakdown at the early call time. Put him out of his misery. Attachment Sunrise 04 plus edit.jpg. Stick You now has a nice blanket, a cappuccino, and a warm sandwich. Attachment Sunrise 04 plus edit plus again.jpg. You forgot to add Stick You, who is taking the photo, so that's his hand at the frame, plus the photo is slightly blurry, because he's still self-conscious about taking photos in public with his cell phone. They find a new lead. A whisper of a lead, really, but it solidifies over the next couple of days and culminates in a second raid that goes better than the first one. Their target is pretty much what Tony thought they were, i.e., small fry thieves / smugglers who've decided to punch above their pay grade, though with connections to high-rolling black market buyers that S.H.I.E.L.D. are eager to learn about. Tony would have tracked the thieves down on his own eventually, but he could admit that this way is faster, and that Pepper will be happy to know where S.I.'s lapses in security were. The raid itself goes smoothly. No one can say that Tony hasn't learned his lesson. He offers and is happily given the role of air support while the others do the actual breaking and entering. It's boring, sure, but there's less chance of friendly fire up in the sky, and he gets to take notes on how S.H.I.E.L.D. operates in the field. "Mostly clear on this side, nothing interesting," Barton says, voice crackling through the armor speakers, hurting the, "Whoa, yep, okay, yeah, that one's yours." "That's two," Romanoff says. "Plus one pencil pusher they left high and dry," Roger says. "Might be able to get something out of this. Anything happening out there, Stark?" "Nope, nothing, just, oop, wait. There's one trying to ditch," Tony says, sending the armor into motion. "Rude." The S.H.I.E.L.D. trio on the ground are efficient for the most part, though each has a touch of showiness. Romanoff enjoys mouthing off her targets before she puts them down. Barton calls out his trick shots, and Rogers, though quieter than the other two, takes three steps when one is usually necessary to get the job done. Their styles match what little Tony's learned from observing them the past few days, and they make a good team. It's kind of a relief to know that Fury doesn't want cold-hearted efficiency. As for Captain America specifically, he's fine. Tony is self-aware enough to acknowledge that Rogers doesn't pick fights with him on purpose, and that the man has a certain clear-headedness that allows him to see through and lead people to a goal without getting distracted. By unspoken agreement, he and Tony have decided to talk around each other as much as they can, aside from the occasional snide comment that can't be helped. This might actually make the top 20 of acceptably functional work relationships that Tony's had in his life. You don't need to like someone to be able to work with them. You don't need to like someone to appreciate their efficiency either. So it is that, once they call it a day and have taken their perps into custody, Tony decides that he'd probably work with them again if he needs to, Captain Rogers included. Tony and the Powerpuff Girls return to the helicarrier for the debrief. The quad jet lands and everyone parts ways for a bit. Barton needs some bruises looked at. Tony hunts down Shield's mess hall in the hopes of coffee, which he finds, while Romanoff and Rogers do whatever. They reconvene at the lab they've been using as their mission base, and Hill helps them go through the day's events. All SI-identified prototypes will be sent to Ms. Potts, Hill says. That good with you? Perfect, Tony says. And we'll have the intelligence team follow up on the rest of the data, Hill says. Anything else anyone wants to add? I'd like to have a crack at the pencil pusher, Barton says. Really? Romanoff says. Yeah, really, Barton shrugs. Just think it's interesting, that's all. You need better hobbies, Romanoff says. All right, I'll rope Clint in for that, Hill says. Anyone else? Tony takes a look around the table. No one else seems about to speak up, which leaves the floor wide open for him. He puts a hand up and says, What are you doing for PR? What's that? Hill says. Public relations. It's a term for... Tony changes tack before Hill's finished rolling her eyes. You guys checked your socials yet? You're going to have to deal with this. His phone is on the table and he turns its screen up to pull a holographic projection in the air. News feeds using grainy footage of their field action fill the window. And by this, I mean this. Well, Hill says slowly, S.H.I.E.L.D. is used to doing things a certain... But you have Captain America, Tony says. Living, breathing Captain America, and you're not doing anything with that? Rogers speaks up. It's been a long day. Can you get to the point? The point, Tony says, is that people are talking about you on the grapevine. Speculation, conspiracies, the whole shebang. Far be it from me to tell you how to do your job. You're going to tell us anyway, Rogers says. But Captain America is an icon that kind of also belongs to the people. You agree? No? No show of hands here. So the thing is... Stark, Rogers says impatiently. How is this in any way constructive? If you're going to do the Avengers project, you have to do it properly. You have to let people see you and know what you're about. And that includes fucking telling people that Captain America has been found. I honestly don't understand why you haven't. Maybe you enjoy putting the spotlight on yourself, but not all of us do, Rogers says. Tony frowns. You're in the history books, Cap. You're telling me that you don't owe people the... Maybe I don't, Rogers snaps. Tony's surprised by the tone, and then surprised that he's surprised in the first place, because they've been doing nothing but snipe at each other this past week. Maybe it's the specific register of voice. Rogers tends to use a calm voice to undercut the words he's actually saying, so it's startling when he raises the volume, like the eerie pull of the shoreline before the tsunami hits. Tony's so taken aback that he doesn't immediately reply, and into the silence Rogers stands up and says, I don't have time for this. Keep going without me if you have to. He marches off, exiting the conference room. A glance around the table confirms that the others are just as surprised. Tony feels off-kilter, and then annoyed, because if Rogers is going to be mad at him, then it had better be because of something Tony actually did on purpose. Tony rises to his feet without really thinking about it. He catches up to Rogers in the corridor, saying, Cap. Rogers doesn't even look at him, but Tony stays level with his pace. Rogers, okay, yes, I get it, you're a busy man. I am too, actually, and I didn't have to bring it up at all, but I know a little something about... Do you never stop? Rogers asks. Does having the last word really matter that much to you? Sometimes, Tony admits. Most of the time. But anyway, I know it might not seem important right now, but you're going to run out of goodwill. Am I supposed to care about that? Isn't it how this whole thing works? Fury asks you to sit up, fetch, roll... Rogers stops suddenly and Tony stops with him. Tony feels a surge of petty triumph at the slow way that Rogers looks at him. It's a look that's worthy of Tony's big mouth. Fury doesn't hold me on a leash, Rogers says. I'm not S.H.I.E.L.D. What? Tony says. Buddy, if you walk like a duck and quack like a duck, maybe you should try to stop thinking about yourself all the damn time, Rogers says. You might notice what's going on around you. Tony rocks back on his heels. Ow. Rogers isn't wrong, but still. Ow. This time when Rogers resumes walking, Tony stays where he is. He watches as Rogers makes it all the way down the corridor without being stopped by anyone and disappears around a corner. I'll notice your lousy mood, that's what, Tony mutters. Sadly, this is still in the top 20 functional work relationships he's ever had, even counting the fact that Rogers is a dick who's prone to snippiness. The comment about Fury is a surprise, though, and Tony spares a second to wish Fury luck trying to handle the guy. Though wouldn't it be hilarious if they rejected Tony for being a wild card, only for Rogers to be one as well? Tony returns to the room and finishes up with the others, now determined to spell out his suggestions in full detail since Rogers shot it down. Tony also tells them that he personally won't get involved, but he can recommend people who know what they're doing and can prove it, judging from how they've managed SI's latest ups and downs after Tony's off-the-cuff announcements. S.H.I.E.L.D. may live for espionage, but the response to Iron Man proves that there are other ways to be effective and open in the world. After that, Tony goes home. He has a nice long bath that Jarvis has to wake him up from, and then drags himself out of the bathroom with the idle thought that maybe he can work on armor for 5 minutes before hitting the hay. That thought is derailed when he sees that there's a message from BD-01432 waiting for him, which is a little odd, because it's Tony's turn to reply in their back and forth. He reads it. Sorry for the extra long message today, but this is a postscript. I needed to get out in case you don't hear from me for a while. Someone very important to me passed away today. She'd been ill for a while, and I knew it was likely to happen soon, but it still blindsided me. She's the last connection I had to a life long lost to me, and now it feels as if that life never happened at all, and I'm not a real person, which is an awful thing to be fixated on because a wonderful woman just died and I'm making it about me. You don't need to be worried. I know to be grateful that I have my health and a job, and other people have far less than that. Yet at the same time, I look around me and wonder at how I could disappear right this instant, and it would make no difference to the world. I wonder that it's easier for me to type this out to you, a person I only know as Cherry Red 32, than to tell anyone who's physically around me. Which is not to say that I've never had meaningful friendships, because I do, and I'm grateful for every single one of them. It just so happened that pretty much all of them are dead, now that this last friend has also passed on. Of course, I don't blame them. It's not their fault, nor is it my fault. It's just the way it is. Sorry for this big lump of nothing. At the very least, it's evidence of how much I need to clear my head. Anyway, you can just ignore this whole thing. I'll send another message soon. Just wanted you to know in case I disappear for a while. Tony exhales slowly, the motion easing the tightness in his chest. He reads the message again, his eye catching all the points in the message where BD-01432 would have normally smoothed over with his usual clear style. The man's hurting and he's alone, which isn't fair. BD-01432 shared this with him when he didn't have to. Tony needs to step up. I'm very sorry for your loss. Of course you're spiraling. You're a human being with a huge heart. And I don't think any of us are ever really prepared for this happening. Your friend may be gone, but now you have to go on without her. And that's rough. That's still awkward, but it's also genuine. And he hopes BD-01432 will be able to tell. God, Tony's terrible at this. He's tempted to search for templates for effective condolence letters, but quickly pushes that aside because BD-01432 doesn't deserve that. Instead, Tony sits quietly for a while, his eyes closed, and thinks about his mom. It happened so long ago. But he can still pull enough emotion of the urgency of the moment, of feeling the world's deep injustice. Distractions helped. Having an outlet to vent helped. Contact helped. What can Tony offer? It's a bad idea. Or a good idea? But mainly a scary idea, because the whole reason this works is because none of what they've talked about can be stuck to them as people whose lives expand outside the online realm. If Tony does this, it could blow up in multiple directions. But his friend's hurting. Doesn't that make it worth it? Fuck it. He's Tony Stark. Go big or go home. He types. If you disappeared, it'd definitely make a difference to me. I may be bites without a face, but I'm still a person where it counts, I think. Would it count more if I met you in person? Disclaimer, I don't actually know where you are aside from your sometimes vague mentions of locations on the eastern seaboard. I swear I'm not being creepy. I know what it's like to feel cut off from the world, alone and tiny. Not the same way you do, but maybe we can be alone in the same place together if you want. No pressure if you don't want to. I'm just making the offer. If you want to do that, or just send me another message at your own pace, or take all the time in the world doing your own thing, I am okay with any and all of it. Take care. XO, XO. Tony hits send, panics, almost retracts the message, then tosses his phone to a corner of the room so he can't look at it anymore. Chapter 5. Stark. Tony gets to the restaurant early. He feels slightly ridiculous about it because coming early eliminates the ability to make a strong entrance, a skill of which Tony has had many years to hone. But knowing your audience matters too, and a strong entrance isn't necessarily what tonight needs. Besides, BD01432 already knows Tony, a part of Tony anyway. So in that sense, the entrance has already been made, and the introduction already been done. This is just a formality, except the opposite of formal, because Tony wants his friend to be at ease and comfortable, hence why Tony's dressed down and has his reading glasses on, since that's part of what the committee has agreed is his most approachable look, the committee being Happy Pepper and a reluctant roadie. The restaurant isn't a crowded one, and Tony got them a table near the back, though the position of Tony's seat and the restaurant's lighting gives him a mostly clear line of sight to the entrance. He has a cup of coffee to keep himself company, and his phone is on the table with BD01432's message from a couple of days ago up on the screen. A part of me wants to decline, because I don't think I have the state of mind that'd make a meeting worthwhile right now. But the other more stubborn part of me very much wants to accept, for the chance to see a fresh face, as well as to put a face to the person I've been corresponding with. Corresponding, Tony mouths to himself with a smile, already the guy sounding more like himself. So here's the decider. Will you be anywhere near New York anytime soon? If yes, I would love to meet you. The messages after that are mostly hashing out the details. It's going to be fine. BD01432 will come in and sit down, and they'll talk the way they've been talking all this while, except it'll be out loud and immediate. Yes, it'll be awkward at first, but the awkwardness will be mutual, and they'll push through. Tony is going to make the effort worthwhile, and hopefully BD01432 will feel less sad by the time dinner is over. Hell, BD01432 might be excited to see that he's the Tony Stark, though chances are just as good that BD01432 has no idea who the Tony Stark even is. That would be hilarious, and Tony fully welcomes the possibility. Mainly, Tony really wants to give BD01432 a hug, or just offer one, if an actual hug is not his thing. Every new arrival is marked by the bell chime of the door opening. Tony looks up from his table each time and measures said arrivals in a split second of observation. Lively pairs and groups are discarded. Young solo arrivals are loosely earmarked as potential persons of interest, but non-young solo arrivals are watched closely, and even more so if they enter the restaurant visibly looking for someone. but everyone ends up heading for a table that's not Tony's. Tony glances at its watch. BD-01432 is late, but just slightly. That's fine. Tony busies himself watching the door, rereading the menu, and checking his phone. The half-hour mark soon ticks by, but that's still fine. It's well within the window of carelessly late, let alone fashionably late. Wouldn't it be funny if BD-01432 wanted to make a strong entrance, too? It might be something he'd do. Another bell chime, but as soon as Tony glances up, the man in the doorway returns the way he came, with only the back of his closely shaven head visible. Tony orders another coffee and rereads BD-01432's recent messages in case he got the date and or location wrong. That happens a lot, admittedly, but everything seems to be in order this time. A bell chime. Tony looks up, blanches, and immediately tries to find a casual and inconspicuous way to cover his face. God damn Steve Rogers. Here in this restaurant of all places. And isn't he supposed to be in D.C.? Tony hasn't seen him since the debrief on the helicarrier, and he'll be damned before he lets the man ruin his night. Maybe he'll sit at some corner away from... A shadow falls over Tony's table. Stark, Rogers says. Nope. Tony shoves a hand out towards him, as if he can push Rogers back by sheer force of thought. No, not interested in small talk. I don't know you. Please sit far away from here. Rogers' face is a pained grimace, as if he doesn't want to be here any more than Tony does. But instead of backing off, he puts a hand on the back of the empty chair in front of Tony and says, Actually, I... That's taken, Tony hisses. Rogers has the gall to look affronted. So Tony grabs the menu and smacks Roger's hand with it until he lets go. I'm expecting someone. I don't want you to scare them off. Well, to tell you that, please, Tony says plaintively, which makes Roger start a little. Please. Tonight is important. I can't mess this up. Roger's mouth opens and then closes. Sadly, Rogers is still blocking Tony's view of the door, forcing Tony to lean sideways past Roger's body to check that he hasn't missed anyone. Finally, blessedly, Rogers moves out of the way. Out of sight will put him out of mind, and Tony is thrilled for all of 2 seconds until he hears a chair get pulled back. Rogers has taken the next table over, which is close enough that Tony could ball up his napkin and throw it right between Rogers' eyes if he wanted to. Rogers even has the cheek to make himself comfortable and browse the menu. Tony grits his teeth and decides to let it go. He can ignore Rogers. He can. After making another check of the door, Tony turns to his phone, tapping the screen and making sure its connection is working. There's nothing new yet, though, not even a message to tell him that he's on his way. Rogers, annoyance extraordinaire, clears his throat. They're late. Don't you dare, Tony says. Don't I dare what? Rogers replies. How the tables turn, that kind of comment. Yes, it's funny. No, I don't care. Tony's eye drifts to the clock on his phone anyway. Over an hour now. He can be as late as he wants. That's... Rogers trails off, assigning the rest of that observation to the realm of mystery. Didn't you say it was important? If that's true, he'd already be here, right? Tony slowly turns his head and pins Rogers in place with an incredulous stare. What's wrong with you? Things happen. Accidents happen. Cars break down. Hell, he's old, so maybe he got sick. He's old? Yeah, so what? Tony suddenly realizes what Rogers must think of the kind of person he's meeting. A hot date, perhaps. Or some business hobnobbing. Goodness knows it's none of his business. But Tony's nerves are frazzled enough that he's compelled to say, He's a friend, all right? He's had a rough time of it lately, and I'm going to cheer him up, so I don't need your peanut gallery comments when he gets here, okay? If he gets here, Rogers says. Geez, have a little imagination, Tony says with a sigh of exasperation. Maybe... The door chime goes off, and Tony turns quickly, but the arrival is a young woman who immediately waves at a table of her friends. Tony feels himself start to deflate, but quickly sits up and checks his phone. No way is he going to give Rogers the satisfaction. But what if something did happen to BD-01432? Tony opens a browser on his phone to check the local news. Chances are low that something obvious will jump out, but it doesn't hurt to look. Maybe he changed his mind, Tony murmurs to himself, just as the thought arrives in his head. And he doesn't want to come. That's okay, too.
Is that a present? Rogers asks quietly.
Tony immediately moves the paper gift bag to the other side of his seat. Eat or quit, Rogers. Rogers thankfully stops talking to Tony after that and orders dinner. Tony orders too, just to get his stomach to stop complaining. He also sends a quick message that he hopes sounds more reasonable in reading than it does as he's typing it.
Hey, hope everything's okay with you. Dinner's today, right?
No hard feelings if you can't make it. He hits send and leaves the screen active. There's no reply. Dinner arrives. Rogers is an unfathomable, hulking presence at the corner of Tony's eye, no matter how much he adjusts his chair. Time passes in intervals marked by the door chime, which steadily slows down to a trickle. None of the new arrivals match a lone adult male that Tony's waiting for, and no one takes another glance at the hourglass keychain Tony's put at the corner of his table as an identifying marker. Tony tries his best to ignore Rogers. The guy's busy reading on his phone, too, scrolling back and forth as though he's doing homework. But every time Tony looks at the door, his self-conscious brain insists that Rogers is looking at him, too. Anyway, Tony really hopes that nothing happened to BD-01432. Things can turn on a dime, after all. BD-01432's latest messages sounded slightly better, but that can be deceiving as well. He'd better not be hurt or have done something stupid.
Hey, so, Rogers says, startling Tony out of his thoughts, are you going to stay much longer?
Rogers' plate has been cleared, and Tony's almost done too, despite how he took his sweet time with each bite. Tony knows he should be annoyed. Why the hell is Rogers asking another dumb question? But he's just tired and worried. How many accidents happen in NYC on a Friday night? Tony should look up the stats. Tony ignores Rogers and waves a server down to order dessert. He vaguely registers Rogers leaving, but it's not as much of a relief as it should be. He hopes that BD-01432 stood him up on purpose. Better that the guy made a conscious choice rather than something bad happened to him, right? That's the logical response. The illogical response would be to feel hurt that BD-01432 didn't care enough to come. After all, Tony wasn't sure if it was a good idea to extend the invite in the first place, and it's just as likely that BD-01432 had his doubts, too. Maybe BD-01432 weighed the pros and cons, or got afraid, or decided it just wasn't worth it. Might have been nice to get a message confirming that, though. But maybe his phone broke, or the battery ran out, on top of whatever else happened to him tonight. Tony stays at the restaurant for as long as he can. Even so, his pride won't let him be the last person left, and he clears out when there's one other occupied table left of a lovey-dovey couple laughing over their empty plates. Tony tucks the gift bag under his arm and steps out into the cool night air. It's cloudy tonight. Tony pulls out his phone one more time, but there's no new message. He opens a new draft and starts typing while waiting for Happy to pick him up.
Funny story, here it goes. I had a nice dinner, the food was great, the coffee less so, but that's always the risk in eating out. Anyway, I'd really appreciate it if you could drop me a line and tell me that you're okay, and that nothing bad happened since your last message. You don't need to tell me anything else.
Wow, that sounds dramatic, but then again, I'm typing this out at the time of night where all emotions feel more dramatic, more there, more. Look at that night sky. There should be gargoyles against that skyline. Attachment, image 06170.jpg. Sum up. I really want to know that you're safe and sound wherever you are. If you are, give me a why. That would be awesome. But if you're not, fine, let me know too, because I'd like to help. Really serious, no joking. This message will look ridiculous in the light of day, and it turns out you were in a train derailment and lost your phone. You can make fun of me all you want,
But if none of the above is the case, and you did come to the restaurant, and seeing me made you change your mind, I understand. I'm sorry. I know I should have warned you about who I am. But it shouldn't matter. At least Tony believes that it shouldn't matter. Not when in messages BD01432 seemed confused and disinterested in modern celebrity. Tony types various attempts at defending himself. Yes, he's famous, but he's still just a guy and wants to meet him. That he doesn't care who BD01432 is and where he is in life. That he knows it can be dangerous to be his friend, but Tony will take care of it. But he deletes all of them. A flash of fear tries to grip Tony as he ponders about what BD01432 could do with what he knows. What if he wakes up tomorrow and there's screenshots all over TMZ about Tony's existential fears? No. BD01432 wouldn't do that. Not when he'd had so many chances to take advantage or spin the conversation to his favor. BD01432 wrote as if he never expected a connection at all, and was continually surprised whenever Tony replied. This mattered. It was brief, but it mattered. If you ever need anything or want to keep chatting, I'm still here. If you want to stop right here, I'm cool with that too. Maybe you're not even reading this. But if you are, please know that getting to read your words all this time has been a true highlight. Getting that little notif in my inbox gave me a buzz every single time. I'm not too cool to admit that. Does this count as a real friendship? I don't know. But it feels like it does. And I want to believe that that's what counts. Thank you for being you. And I wish you all the happiness in the world. Chapter 6. Rogers. Tony has been aware this whole time that BD01432's messages could stop at any given moment. In the early days, he sometimes even wished that they would stop, because BD01432's messages were pretty long due to the guy's unfamiliarity with online social norms, but said messages were also interesting and thus commanded Tony's attention. Tony feels a little silly to be so bereft at being technically ghosted, but he reminds himself that BD01432 doesn't seem like the kind of person who'd ghost anyone on purpose. And Tony was really fucking enjoying himself, so of course it's a bummer to have that small source of joy taken away from him. He'll get over it soon, though. He knows himself, and there'll be something else to get his attention. Probably. In the meantime, though, he indulges himself with two things. One, he rereads BD01432's messages for clues. BD01432 did reply to the message Tony sent after he left the restaurant, but it's an utterly useless, "I'm sorry, I'm fine, but meeting up was a bad idea. You've been a good friend. I really appreciate it." Which tells Tony nothing. The "fine" is suspicious, and the lack of explanation compounds Tony's frustration. BD01432 was looking forward to meeting up. That's clear enough. But maybe there's something to be gleaned from the guy's earlier messages, some clue that Tony missed that can make sense of everything. Tony hasn't replied to that message either, since he's still thinking of what to say that won't scare the guy off completely. 2. Tony can keep checking local NYC news portals. Maybe BD01432 is embarrassed by something that happened that night, and it made him change his mind about meeting him. Tony doesn't know what he's looking for exactly, but he feels like he'd recognize it if he sees it, e.g., elderly gentleman with amnesia found wandering the Metropolitan Museum, that kind of thing. "Are we boring you, Stark?" Fury says. "Absolutely not," Tony says, though he keeps scrolling for another beat before looking up. The conference room has the usual occupancy. Fury and Hill are at the head of the table, while the rest of Fury's crew fill out the seats. "I still don't think you're clear about your objectives." "Huh," Barton says. "I thought that was the only part that was clear." "Maybe pretend a little harder that you're paying attention," Romanoff says. "This was your idea, Stark," Hill says, ignoring the other two. "And now you don't want to be part of it?" "Only here as a consultant," Tony says. "I'm just saying, if your only point is to go out there and say, 'Here he is,' then you might as well buy a billboard and save everyone's time." Explain that, Rogers says. It's the first time in a while that Rogers has spoken up, and the suddenness makes Tony jump a little. What? Tony says. Explain your thinking, Rogers says. About objectives. Tony sighs. It's a press conference for you. For Captain America and how he's back in the world. Please applaud now. And, Rogers says. For a moment, Tony thinks that this has to be a trap and that Rogers is goading him. But he can't see any reason for it aside from the possibility that Rogers thinks Tony is trying to trap him. So Tony goes, why does it need to be a press conference? And why only now? Are you warning people that you're out there? Are you making yourself available as a publicish figure? Have you been backed into a corner by circumstance? Like your press conference, Rogers says, the I am Iron Man. Tony frowns a little, but he doesn't think it's mockery, just a statement. Not the same. I did that to stop people speculating. He broke a script, Fury says. To tell the truth, Rogers says. Sure, okay, Tony says, uncertain where this is going. Still not the same. Same or not, Rogers says. Why do you not want to be involved in this one? Because if I'm there, it shifts the spotlight, Tony says with a sigh. It's no longer about how Captain America's been found. It becomes, what is Captain America going to do next, and how Iron Man comes into that. But we've already teamed up, and people know that, Rogers points out. There's footage. That's an isolated incident, and not necessarily part of the narrative you're making. If I'm there, I'm part of that story, and you need to consider all that baggage listed in Romanoff's little write-off. Worse yet, people are going to bring up the Howard connection. Did I have a role in finding you? Which I didn't. How do I feel about not being involved in finding you? Which is nothing. What do I think dear old dad would feel about it today? Which I honestly do not give a hoot about. And that's not even getting started on what they're going to ask you. We answer any of this honestly? It'll do neither of us any favors. You don't have to give such answers, though, Barton says. Again, that's S.H.I.E.L.D. thinking, Tony says. Tony does prefer to tell the truth, Romanoff says, especially if the truth upsets people. Thanks, Tony says. Funnily enough, Hill adds, that's something you have in common with Captain Rogers. What? No, Tony protests, at the same time that Rogers makes a faint choking sound. She's not wrong, Romanoff says. Not to upset people, Rogers says, almost defensively. He turns to Tony. Then why did you suggest that I do this at all? Selfish reasons, of course, Tony says. I am Iron Man. I'm not going to stop, and people are going to be asking me about you. They already have, actually, though I can share with the class that I haven't replied to any emails asking for comment. Stark is right, Fury says, which is a wild trio of words in a row to hear from the guy. The Avengers need to be bigger than S.H.I.E.L.D., and this needs to be that first step that makes that clear. I still think that's a name that courts trouble, Barton says. No offense, sir.
Incredible offense taken, but I'm choosing to ignore it, Fury replies. So let's go around again. What are we doing this for?
Tony half tunes out as the conversation starts up again. Oh, he still participates, and notes that Rogers is participating as well, but his brain's mostly elsewhere. By the time Fury calls it, they have an action plan, and Tony has both browsed 5 different local NYC news portals and mentally designed an alternate power coupling for the arc reactor. He stands up as the others do, and along the way, stretches his arms to work out a kink in his shoulder. You're looking tired, Tony, Romanoff says. Fun weekend? You know me, Tony says. Partied hard, all the way from Friday punch-out. A self-conscious jolt goes through his body when he remembers that Rogers is right there. He glances sideways, but Rogers is busy reading his tablet, his impassive expression unchanged. You say that as though your idea of fun these days doesn't involve a gold titanium alloy flying armor, Romanoff says. She takes Tony's wry smile with an amiable nod and wanders off to loop her arm in Barton's. The others meander out of the room, leaving Rogers, who finally packs his tablet away in an actual old man's satchel, and Tony, who takes his time putting his jacket back on. Rogers registers Tony's presence with a subtle turn of his head. Tony expects to feel embarrassed,
a belated reaction to Roger seeing him at the restaurant since he was too busy being annoyed and distracted at the time. But there's no embarrassment that rises up, just an annoyed curiosity that nags at him like a loose tooth. Tony clears his throat. You didn't tell the others about Friday that you saw me. Get stood up, he doesn't add. Roger seems confused, as though it hadn't occurred to him. No, he says. A statement of fact, not smug or forceful at all. Difficult to read in its neutrality. I didn't. Okay, Tony shifts awkwardly. Right. Yeah. Tony starts to turn away, but is stopped by Roger saying, I'm sorry, it didn't work out. Again, Tony suspects foul play, as if Rogers is about to say something politely cutting about Tony's choice of friends or social skills. But again, the guy seems sincere. Tony suddenly remembers that Steve was alone that night too, though there's no telling whether that was on purpose or not, which is none of Tony's business. Perhaps that's where this maybe sympathy is coming from. Okay. Maybe it's for the best. Rogers winces, a full tick of awkward emotion that cascades across that chiseled face. Sorry, I didn't mean it like that. What did you mean it like, then? Tony asks cautiously. I meant that it was probably not worth it, Roger says. If he stood you up like that, that tells you what kind of person he is, doesn't it? Tony opens his mouth to defend BD-01432, but the energy saps out of him almost immediately. That last brief message of utter vagueness has been his only company all weekend, and it hasn't helped at all. Maybe, Tony says at last. I just wish... He shrugs. You're still worried. Rogers gestures at Tony's phone. The screen is dark now, but Tony knows exactly what he was browsing 5 minutes ago. Anyone tell you it's rude to read off someone's phone like that? Tony asks. A few people have, yes. Tony starts a little. A joke? From Rogers? It doesn't seem so at first, but Tony can see the fine tells in Rogers' eyes, little imperfections that hint at a wry sense of humor. Rude? Tony's further surprised when a corner of Rogers' mouth pulls in what could be an almost smile. But yeah, I don't mind so much the part about getting ditched, or getting ditched at a restaurant and having to deal with you instead. Rogers twitches a little, so Tony adds, you know what I mean. Sure, Rogers says. I just want to know that the guy isn't in trouble, that's all, Tony says helplessly, that he hasn't hurt himself. Hurt himself? Rogers echoes in surprise. The guy was having a hard time. I thought I could do something about it. Maybe I can't. But I don't like not knowing if he's actually okay. Ah, Rogers nods. That makes sense. Right. Tony pushes his hands into his jacket pockets. I'm going now. A strange conversation, but not a bad one. Rogers had shades of sympathy, but there was something else, too. Something hesitant in his manner that had Tony instinctively wary. Whatever the case, voicing his worry out loud to someone who doesn't really care puts a few things in perspective. Fact is, Tony could find the answer if he really wanted. Just punch some tracking code into Jarvis, cross-reference it with various details that BD-01432 casually told him over his messages, and Tony could probably find the actual guy, within a margin of error for exaggeration or white lies, of course. But doing it that way won't make him feel better. Tony leaves D.C., and makes a stop at SI's New York branch to harass a couple of divisions. After that, he's off for home and spends the evening doing a test flight under poor visibility, where he gets to put the suit's radar imaging through its paces. Hence, Tony is miles up in the air when a notification sound comes in. Jarvis, Tony says. Yes, sir. It's from your pen pal. Huh, really? He sent more than 2 lines this time? It would seem so. Oh, shit, okay, we're landing. Where are we? No, wait, take over. Fly us home and bring the message up. A window appears on the HUD, and in it a fresh message from BD-01432 that's not a pathetic collection of short sentences. Tony follows the text eagerly. Dear friend,
My apology comes in twofold, for both what happened on Friday and for the poor excuse that was my previous message. I never meant to worry you or ruin our dinner, as trite as that may sound. I promise that I'm safe and sound, though I do appreciate the offer to help. Unfortunately, I can't go into more detail than that. I hope you believe me when I say that this was a real friendship to me, too. You gave me something solid to look forward to, and I'm grateful for all the time that you've given me. That said, I believe that we have reached a natural limit on this back and forth. I thought that extending our conversation into the non-virtual world would be the simplest thing to do, but that's turned out to not be the case. While I've enjoyed writing to you, I didn't realize how much I've been relying on writing as a crutch. Here is a cordoned off channel that I can be candid, while elsewhere I fail at the spoken word. I know that I would have disappointed you in person, even more so than I've already disappointed you in writing. But your guess was right, for I now know who you are, and that makes any further conversation between us unequal. I truly wish it could have played out differently, but some things are beyond our control. Thank you for everything, and goodbye. The armor comes in for a landing in Tony's workshop. The pieces come off into the automated frame, and Tony trips out onto the floor, his head spinning. "Fuck you, mister," Tony says loudly in the workshop. Dummy beeps questioningly, and Tony taps him on the head before jogging past to the workstation. "Mr. B.D. Number is a fan of non-answers and gave me an ulcer for nothing. I hope you get tendonitis." The flash of anger feels good because it's accompanied by a release from worry, but it can't last, and it doesn't last. Tony channels his energy into working with his hands, and by the time he's hammered out new stabilizer fins for the armor, the red-hot rage has leached away to a different kind of bereavement. "Okay, I don't want you to get tendonitis." Tony leaves the workbench for the computer station, where he pulls up the message in a window. "But what is this? What is this? I would have disappointed you in person? I wish it could have played out differently? What does that even mean?" The message may be longer, but the lack of proper explanation is baffling. If we were someone else, maybe Tony would be less bothered, but this is BD-01432, whose directness and clarity of communication made him stand out in the first place. A quiet part of Tony's brain reminds him that he said that he only wanted BD-01432 to confirm that he's fine, and Tony should be satisfied with that answer. But to be satisfied with that would require Tony to be a more sensible and mature person. But since he isn't, he fires up his keyboard and types. "A few things. 1. I'm glad you're okay. That's most important. 2. I guarantee you that I've already considered the possibility that we'd both just sit there like clumsy blind dates who don't know what to say to each other. I don't think it's fair of you to decide that I'll be disappointed in you when chances are just as good that you'd be disappointed in me. Which brings me to my next point. 3. Did I do something to you before, and that's why you're cutting me off? I did a lot of things, so I'm aware there's a very high possibility that this is the case, and a part of me doesn't want to know the details because it'll ruin all the nice vibes of all your past messages, but the other part of me needs to know. I can't change the past, but I can try to make the present better. Maybe I can't, but I'd like the chance to try. 4. Sad face. Tony hits send with a vicious stab of the return key. He then sits there for a while to breathe heavily and bask in the moment. Admittedly, it might have been better to sleep on the message and reply in the morning, but the honesty of the moment might be. The trill of an incoming message makes Tony jump. BD-01432 is still awake at this time of night? "You have to stop messaging me. I know who you are. And you have no idea who I am or what I might do. My decision to stop communicating has nothing to do with assigning blame to either side. It's simply because I believe the rapport we had online cannot translate to the outside world. Either way, this communication is now very unsafe, and you need to take care of yourself. I won't be replying any further.
Unsafe? Tony echoes in disbelief.
He opens a reply window and starts typing.
Since you know who I am, then you should know that I eat risk for breakfast. Anyway, take your own advice and block me first. The button is right there. You'll never see another message from me again. I might just keep sending noise into the void because who's going to stop me? You? Anyway, I'm sending you a picture of the very nice watercolor supplies I got for you. Look at this beautiful set. Now it's going into storage.
Attachment, image 08013.jpg. He sends the message and stays where he is, eye lingering eagerly on the window. When BD01432 says he's going to do something, he actually does it. But maybe this once.
Well, Tony can hope for something without realistically expecting it to happen.
Regardless, Tony gives it a couple of minutes, then throws his hands up and goes to bed.
Chapter 7. Tony.
I suppose since I can send you these things now, here's what it looks like from about 5 miles up.
Attachment image 13.05.14.jpg.
If I were a morning person, I could give your morning photos a run for their money, but since I'm not, you went on a technicality.
Your watercolors didn't go to waste. Look at this piece. You'll never guess who made it.
Attachment 14.11.01.jpg.
Okay, I'll tell you. I have a couple of robots and they painted it. Sadly, I didn't ask them to do it. They just found your package and went ham. Better this than a robot uprising, I guess.
Tony lands the armor on sand, which is the opposite of ideal, but at least gives him a new testing variable.
An immediate lesson is that the soles of the armor's boots hate soft, uneven surfaces, even more than hard, uneven surfaces. Despite his having made an ideal three-point landing, it's only by the grace of his hand repulsors that he doesn't topple over face first. Eventually, he stands up, pops the faceplate open, and takes a deep breath.
Am I smoking? I smell like I'm smoking, Tony says.
That's the burning truck, sir, Jarvis says.
Spectacular.
Tony does a quick check of his person, confirming that all biological and mechanical systems are in order. The lull gives Rogers a chance to come over in a brisk jog from the scene of said burning truck. Romanoff and Barton must have the situation under control, and it probably helps that the local law enforcement has finally arrived. Another day, another close call. Damn it, he needs to be faster.
Hi there.
Rogers removes his helmet as he approaches. Thanks for the assist.
I was in the area, Tony says.
Well, not in the area, but close enough.
Anyone I should know?
Wait, no, don't tell me. I don't have time to come in for a debrief.
Fury will call you in anyway, Rogers points out.
I'll send her to voicemail.
Tony turns and realizes that they're closer to the boardwalk than he'd expected. Civilians are flocking forward to gawk and take photos of the scene, but they're mostly still keeping their distance. There near the front is an opportunistic hot dog vendor. Tony raises a gauntlet to get his attention.
Hey, kid, give me one of those.
Hungry? Rogers asks.
Like you're not, Tony says. Don't you burn calories extra fast or something like that?
You're right.
And with that, Rogers takes off on another brisk jog towards the vendor, that huge shield of his strapped to his back like a bullseye.
Tony watches bemused as Rogers talks to the vendor and politely ignores the various civilians who have turned their cell phone cameras towards him.
Tony didn't watch the press conference that announced Rogers' return to the world, but Jarvis gave him the highlights, and he figured that someone would have called him if it was a disaster. In any case, Rogers seems to be rolling with his newfound fame. While waiting for the hot dogs, he waves a little hello to the crowd and makes a gesture that's clearly advising people to stay back and assuring them that everything's fine.
Tony has the suit to take a picture.
There's been no answer for days, and it's likely that BD01432 has blocked him. But Tony opens a holographic screen on his gauntlet and starts typing. He knows that he'll stop sending these one day, when the most dramatic or emotionally satisfying moment makes itself known. But today is not that day.
You grow up with this guy? attachment, image 18.21.13.jpg. Don't know if you've been following the news, but he's back. A bit surreal. Kind of like I'm working with Santa Claus. Though flying reindeer might be an actual thing these days. Who knows? Tony hits send, dismisses the screen, and looks up into the face of one Steve Rogers, who's back with his hands full. Business email, very important, Tony says. I'm sure it was, Rogers says. Tony accepts his hot dog, and the pair of them eat while watching another Quinjet land near the smoking ruins of the thwarted attack target. That's Furion Hill, here to make everyone's day a little worse. Did Hill invite you to the press conference? Rogers asks suddenly. Thought we agreed I shouldn't be part of it, Tony says. We agreed that you shouldn't be in front of the cameras, yes. But there was the lunch afterward, without the press. Tony looks at Steve in confusion. Did I need to be there? No, it wasn't necessary, Rogers says. Tony expects there to be more to that, but Rogers is focused on finishing his hot dog, and Tony has the strangest feeling of having taken a misstep somewhere. It's an annoying feeling. I think Hill asked, Tony says. Can't remember. Ah. More silence. It's hard to tell if this silence counts as awkward because Tony's pretty sure Rogers could just bounce back to his crew, who are by now arguing with the local law enforcement. Yet Rogers is still here, chewing manfully as he gazes to the inexplicable middle distance. Did you want something? Tony asks. I mean, Fury asked about a helicarrier audit, but there's some approval process before I can be on site. No, I don't know anything about that, Rogers says. I do have a question, though. Sure. If Fury changes his mind, would you reconsider the Avengers initiative? Tony barks a laugh. The one Romanoff gave me a 4F for, you mean? If you know your Captain America lore, you'd know that that didn't stop me. Tony side-eyes him, but Rogers has the uncanny ability to say things like that and sound like he's being wryly self-deprecating instead of smug. Yeah, okay, to answer you, no, I probably wouldn't. Why? This is disarming, too. The question is sincere, yet lacks the weight of a full-on demand. It gives Tony the strangest sense of déjà vu, which shouldn't have any place here because he can still count on one hand the number of conversations he's had with this man that haven't involved shouting at each other. Yes, it's mostly Tony doing the shouting, but Rogers shouts spiritually, so it still counts. Not going to crawl back to where I'm not wanted, Tony says. Is that the real reason? Rogers says. Well, part of it, Tony admits. It's also, I mean... He waves his hand towards Hill, Barton, and Romanoff, and the handful of other S.H.I.E.L.D. agents on the scene. I get that it must be frustrating to live in a world where not everyone thinks as fast as you do, Rogers says. But can you connect the dots for me? Look at them. Look at you, Tony says. You're all military/espionage people. Even if you're not as tied to Fury as you say you are, you're still a soldier. And that other guy you recommended to Fury, the bird guy? Sam Wilson? Yes, him. He's military too. What does that tell you, huh? I may have been around military almost my entire life, but I'm not one of you. I don't fit in, and like hell am I going to try. Rogers nods. What if you come up with potentials? What? Did Fury show you the complete list? Rogers says. There are others he scouted but not approached. There are a few scientists on there, and off the top of my head, there's one not far from where you're based. Her father used to be with S.H.I.E.L.D., but she herself is not, and I'm pretty sure she's not military. There are others, too. Fury's not going to want suggestions from me, Tony says. Pretty sure he wouldn't. We can try, Rogers says with a shrug. Would be a better idea anyway to have people with different backgrounds.
It might,
Tony says hesitantly. Do you want the list? I don't know if you have clearance, but I can check. Then maybe we can discuss it. Tony stares at him for another beat. Okay. Got it. Rogers makes a small movement with his head, as though he's marking an internal checklist. Then he crumples up the paper wrapper that once held his hot dog and takes Tony's wrapper to add to it. A casual swing of a super soldier arm sends the paper ball and a perfect parabolic arch into a distant trash can. Some people applaud, and Rogers acknowledges them with another awkward little wave. The guy is evidently about to leave, so Tony clears his throat. Rogers turns back. His hair has a cowlick from the helmet, which is an odd detail to notice out of nowhere. Hey, so, Tony curses the armor's lack of pockets in which he can conveniently shove his hands into. I just remembered that Howard had a bunch of your stuff. When you went. A lot of it was taken by the government, but he managed to hold on to a couple of boxes. If you're ever in Malibu, you can stop by, if you still want any of it. I'd like that, Rogers says. How do I contact you? You have my number, right? Wait, no, not the one Hill uses. Jarvis, send a message to Rogers with the other line. Done, sir. I appreciate it. Rogers squares up as if he's about to salute, but at the last minute sheepishly realizes that he shouldn't. Instead, he nods and sprints back to his team while Tony watches. I'm going to kick his ass if he's softening me up for something, Tony mutters. Make a note of that, Jay. If it was disconcerting to have a civilized conversation on a beach, it's even more disconcerting to have Steve Rogers actually show up on Tony's doorstep a couple of days later, and in full civvies, no less. When Tony opens the door for him, Rogers is in the motion of running a hand through his hair. He has more of that helmet hair, though said helmet has been left on his motorbike, which is currently resting at the base of the steps leading up to the front door. Punctual, Tony says. When I can be, Rogers replies. Rogers follows him into the house, which gives Tony a breather from having to process Rogers' dress casually. Jeans and a shirt of faded storm blue under an open leather jacket. Tony's years-honed instinct to peacock when someone attractive is around is forcibly quashed. It's just fucking Rogers, for crying out loud. Besides, it's not like the fact that Rogers is easy on the eyes is new. He is, Tony noticed. He noticed from way back when, thanks to dear old dad's collection of newsreels. This is me, Tony says, gesturing expansively at the place. Don't be scared of the computer in the ceiling. Mind your P's and Q's. Do people really still say that? Rogers asks. I don't actually know, Tony says. You can leave your jacket there if you want. Tony leads the way into a part of the house that he doesn't go often, with Rogers following close and looking around but not asking for details. The rooms here have been maintained and kept clean, but they're not used much. An office he and Pepper mostly use for SI photo ops, a game room that's mostly for Rhodey, plus a storage room that doesn't look like one. Here, Tony unlocks the door. Howard never saw this house, but I wanted to make a storeroom that looked like his study, based on what I can remember of it anyway. Rogers looks around the round room in disbelief. The 70s trappings are a little after Rogers' time, but it's clearly different enough from the rest of the house that the point is made, even before taking into account the stacks of boxes in it. It's really never used as a study? Rogers asks. Tony points at the shelves. Not real books, not real paintings, not a real mini bar. So it's just for the look of it? Pretty much. Tony gestures at the handful of boxes that have been pulled out from the rest and set near the desk. Those are yours. That is a real chair and cushions, though, so you can sit there. Got it. Roger seems already distracted by the boxes and is running his fingers over the faded labels. Take your time, Tony says. Tell Jarvis if you need anything. Rogers nods, and Tony leaves him to it. Truth be told, Tony expected Rogers to take most of the afternoon excavating Howard's hoard, but it's barely an hour before Rogers traipses down with a box that he puts on the counter. Tony was in the workshop, but came up as soon as Jarvis said that Rogers was done. I'd like to keep this, Rogers says. You can decide what to do with everything else. That's it? Tony says. That doesn't look like a lot. It's what I want to keep, Rogers says firmly. You can throw the rest away, or donate it, if you think that's worthwhile. All right. This feels wrong. incomplete. The room should be filled with their usual griping, but there's only empty space, and Roger's somewhat melancholy air. Tony can't do anything about the latter, but he needs to fill up the former. Noise into the vacuum. He's good at that. You want a drink? Got some coffee there. Tony gestures at the machine. Oh, sure, Roger says. Thank you. Tony hangs back for a moment and watches how Rogers turns to the custom machine, considers the various buttons carefully, and gets it on the first try. There's a little furrow between his eyebrows as he does it, and he bobs his head in a satisfied nod when the coffee is dispensed properly in the mug. 5 stars. Good job. Tony almost says that out loud. Anything good in your haul? Tony asks. Rogers looks at the box. Some old books and photos. Not the good photos, though. I think most of those have gone to museums. You visited any of those? The ones that exhibit your stuff? Once. Roger's face contorts a little, like he'd rather throw himself out a window than elaborate any further. You can probably get some of that stuff back, Tony says. Hell if I know how it works. But if you make enough of a fuss, you might. I don't want to do that. But it's your stuff. It's someone's, Rogers says with a shrug. I don't really, he smiles, or more accurately speaking, he pulls his mouth into what should technically be called a smile, but just looks painful. Your house is nice. Thanks, Tony says, magnanimously allowing the change of topic. Steve Rogers is apparently goddamned awful at small talk, which should not be as delightful a discovery as it is. You want to have a look at where I make the suits? Surprise lights up Roger's eyes. Yes, if you're offering. I'd make you sign an NDA, but come on. Tony leads Rogers down to the workshop, which he'd left in standby mode, and conveniently has some things he doesn't mind letting someone see in its unfinished state. Old armors, Tony says, flicking a hand to light up the display cabinets. The Mark I you've read about in my file, yeah? The original was destroyed, but USAF salvaged some of it, and I put it back together-ish. The suits after that, arranged in order, save that Mark II that Rhodey stole from me. Stole, Rogers echoes politely. I said what I said, Tony says airily. Anyway. As Tony goes through a TED Talk light, he notes Rogers' movements, how he's careful not to touch or bump into anything. How he looks at what Tony's talking about when he's talking about it. How he lingers on certain things that seem to interest him but only asks about them when Tony doesn't bring them up first. The multiple holographic screen setup specifically, and why it's arranged the way it is. They end up at one of the benches, where Tony shows him pieces of the Mark V that he'd taken apart after the Vanco incident to study. But it's weight that trips me up, Tony says, handing over a split gauntlet to Rogers, who hefts it from one hand to another. I don't know if it's worth trying to make another one, when I should focus on making the flight-capable ones better. It's true, a compact suit would be very convenient in a civilian setting, Rogers says. Goodness knows, I tend to second-guess when I should or shouldn't be carrying my shield around, and that's only one thing. Can't even pretend it's an extra-large dinner plate. Or a newfangled umbrella. Or a newfangled cup topper. Only you'd have a coffee cup that big, Tony. Tony's laughter spills out unthinkingly, and he grabs the gauntlet from Roger's hand in mock petulance. Rogers lets go of said gauntlet, but immediately picks up another dismantled piece from the bench, and he twirls it between deft, strong fingers. Tony lets him. What is happening? Do you mind if I ask you a question? Rogers says. Go ahead. This is all very impressive. Rogers casts his eye about the room. But it's very different from what you did with SI. Yes, I mean, you were familiar with my infamous and oft-parodied press conference. No, not that, Rogers says, shaking his head. When running Stark Industries, you didn't do everything yourself. You had whole teams of technicians and researchers. I still do, Tony says. Have you seen our green division? I gave them a kick in the balls recently.
And that's very nifty. But what about this? The Iron Man armors. You let Colonel Rhodes have one. You have no evidence that that's what happened. But everything else you keep such a tight lid on. You won't even let Fury have a look at anything unless it's an older version. Is control that important to you? Or is it that you don't think anyone will understand what you're doing? Rogers winces self-consciously. I was wondering, I guess, if that's something you've thought about. I have, Tony says slowly. Rogers' old vigilante comment rings in his ears, though it's hard to tell if the man is thinking about that specific moment. You're right, it's about control. Rogers nods. He'd possibly take that as a full answer, even. Tony continues. I was betrayed by someone I'd known my whole life. While I wasn't paying attention, yes, I know I'm bad at that. He took my life's work and, used it to do a lot of damage. But at the end of the day, that was my tech that killed innocent people. That's on me. I'm responsible. I can't let that happen again. Not with the suits. Not while I'm still alive. I'm sorry that happened to you, Rogers says. But you don't approve, right? Tony presses. Of my methods. Right or wrong, you'll face it and course correct if you need to. Fact is, you made a difficult call and are seeing it through, which is admirable enough in itself. Roger shrugs, as if he hasn't just given Tony a tiny heart attack. These days, the only thing I can be sure about is that we have to work with the world that actually exists, rather than the one we wish it was. So it's only natural that you're cautious about letting people get close. As if you're so approachable. Rogers nods ruefully. I know I'm not. That's not a bad thing, Tony says, louder than he means to. Rogers gives him a withering look, so Tony continues. It can be, I guess. But even you have to be careful. Bet lots of people want to take advantage of you, handsome stud that you are. Thanks, this is serum. Oh, so you're taking my job now. I'm talking about how you keep cracking quips at your own expense, because you're not good at that. You can keep at it if you like, Roger says amiably. Oh, no, no, that is a trap, and I know traps, Tony said, though he's laughing. Roger smiles too, which shouldn't make Tony's toes curl in his shoes, but it's been a strange day. Next thing you're going to be asking is if I know what I'm doing. I don't think anyone really knows what they're doing, Roger says. Not even you? Tony hums thoughtfully. Not even you. Figuring it out as you go along, huh? Of course. I've had to relearn a lot of things. Roger sounds distant for a moment, but then he's back with a wry smile. World seems bigger and smaller and faster all at the same time. Gotta live up to being Cap on top of that. Cap as we remember him, Tony says with a nod. Not as you actually were. Roger starts a little. Yes. That is tough. Hard for the rest of us to live up to that. Gotta be harder still for you. You know, when I was a kid, Howard used you as a cudgel. If you don't sit down and be quiet, Captain America will be very upset. That kind of thing. Like Santa Claus? Tony gasps. Yes, that's it exactly. Though who the hell knows what presents you're supposed to be handing out to good little girls and boys? War bonds, probably, Roger says, with another little laugh that makes Tony's skin tingle. Sorry about that. For what? Not your fault that your reputation took on a life of its own? Tony shrugs. I understand that. Roger's steady blue gaze seems fathoms deep. So much is going on in there, and meeting those eyes has Tony feeling adrift and confused, though not necessarily in a bad way. The air has shifted, growing thick with possibility. If Rogers were someone else, Tony might parse this as an invitation to flirt. He'd turn the charm way up, invite Rogers to stay for dinner, and maybe wheedle him into letting Tony take a peek into the box of highly personal keepsakes that he's decided are worth keeping. But what's more realistic? That Tony is hyper-aware of the fact that a very attractive man who seems interested in his work is also sitting kind of close, so it's making Tony project a vibe that would flatter his own ego? Or the man with whom Tony has been at loggerheads since they first met
has randomly decided to start maybe flirting with him. There's a split second where Tony could swear that Roger's eyes dropped to Tony's lips, but then Roger startles, head jerking backwards, and the moment breaks. "Wow, look at the time," Tony says sharply. He makes an exaggerated check of his watch to cover the fact that his face is warm and he's freshly anointed himself. Of course he's been getting vibes off of Rogers. The guy's been pestering him about the Avengers initiative, that's all. "Oh, right." Roger sounds a little flustered, but that's also probably Tony's imagination. "I suppose you're busy." "Yeah, I've got some..." Tony casts his eye over the screens quickly. "Testing backlog, so much of that." "Ah, sorry for taking up your time." "No, it's fine. I asked you to come." Tony stands up to leave and Rogers mirrors him. "Right, your things. I'm glad we got that settled." "Would it be okay if I see you again soon?" Roger says as he follows Tony up the stairs. "There's some things I'd like to talk to you about." "Sure, I can pencil it in. Not this week, though. I'm swamped with a thing."
"Oh, no problem."
Roger seems surprised that Tony has already herded him back to his box, which has been waiting for him at the counter. "I'll text you." "Yeah, you do that." A few minutes later, Rogers has his possessions secured to the back of his motorbike, and Tony watches from the front door as the man drives off and out of view. Tony is thrumming, body and mind both, from the activity of the day, though it's hard to tell if said thrumming is from satisfaction with a job well done or frustration at a job left incomplete. He goes back into the house and considers the little markers of Roger's presence, the used mug, the lingering dust on the counter where he'd put the box down. He realizes with a start that he hasn't thought about BD-01432 all day. Huh. But now that he has, he considers sending a vague message about house guests who bring weird vibes with them. But as soon as he takes out his phone and opens the chat window, his most recent message stares back at him and makes him pause. His initial worry about BD-01432 has had time to turn into anger, then to frustration and unfulfilled guilt, and now chilly awareness that he's inching towards pathetic. Either BD-01432 has blocked him, or he hasn't, and is choosing not to reply. Which is worse? Besides, is Tony's need to hold on merely because there's still unanswered questions? Or is it just because he's assigned deeper meaning to words on a screen than there ever was to begin with? He's pretty sure. No, he knows BD-01432 cared. He knows BD-01432 enjoyed talking with him. But whatever joy BD-01432 had gotten out of it was not enough to overcome whatever else was going on with him. And that may be a fact that no one can change, not even Tony. "You did tell him he can end it if he wants to," Tony's treacherous brain tells him. Tony sighs and puts his phone away. For now. Chapter 8. Steve. Tony's tendency for the melodramatic means that it was probably always going to end this way. He struck up an unlikely online friendship that's turned out to be a bust, and after 2 weeks of steadily decreasing crabbiness about it, he's finally ready to let go. It's BD-01432's loss, after all. So it is that Tony sends one final message that may or may not ever be read by its recipient, but puts a definite cap on this little adventure. Farewell. Adieu. "I think about dying all the time. Not the act of dying, but the fact that death creeps closer every day. We've talked about it before, but the urgency I carry with me is still so new and weighted by frustration at wasted time and limited time. I have so much to do, so many things I want to leave behind, and no idea how little time I have left to do it. Why am I so late? Why am I so late? As a parting farewell, I'd like to commission a drawing from you. You can choose the subject, but it has to be something from your daily life that brings you joy. I'll leave the payment for you in my will, and you can give the drawing to my estate. I'm sure they'll do something tasteful with it." Tony sends the message
with a clumsy tap of his phone's touchscreen and rolls over to find a cooler patch of sheet to lie on. He drifts off into an uncomfortable facsimile of sleep, though he's woken up an uncertain amount of time later by a trilling beep.
"What?"
he mumbles. "Message in your inbox, sir," Jarvis says helpfully. "One of the few that you haven't put on mute." Tony grabs his phone. His foggy brain doesn't parse that specific notification tone, and it takes seeing the message itself before it clicks.
"What's going on? Are you hurt? Are you sick?"
"Oh, now," the guy answers. "The fucker didn't block him after all. That's interesting." Tony lies down, too tired to figure out how he feels, beyond fuzzy surprise. Is he relieved, disappointed, annoyed? Emotions require so much energy. While Tony's still thinking, there's the trill of another message arriving.
"Please answer me. I'm sorry for not responding to your messages. Are you in trouble?"
"Ha!" Tony groans when the sound rattles up his throat.
"Worried, are you? Serves you right."
Composing an effective reply needs thinking, so it's a pity that Tony's not so good at that right now. He manages about half a thought before he realizes he's drifting again and tries to focus. This happens a few times, and then he falls asleep, the phone dropped and forgotten. The next time he wakes up, it's to the doorbell. Tony blinks rapidly.
"What?"
"Front door, sir. Captain Rogers."
"The hell for?"
Tony fumbles his way into sitting up and tries to think.
"Did I forget something?
Is he here for more of his stuff?"
"Unclear, sir. But Maria Hill has been trying to contact you for the past few hours."
"While I was asleep?"
Tony squints at the windows. It has to be late afternoon by now, and his missed meal is going to cash in that debt soon.
"Call for pizza, a couple of boxes, you know what I like."
"Very good, sir," Jarvis replies.
Tony thrusts his hands into the pile of blankets to grab one, which he wraps around himself. Cocoon achieved, he trudges his way to the front door. Jarvis has, of course, opened the gates and let Steve and his motorbike in, and the man himself is standing on the front step. He jumps a little when Tony opens the door.
"Oh, is this a bad time?"
Steve asks, just as Tony says,
"This better be an emergency."
They look at each other, judging from Steve's awkward wince, it isn't an emergency. But luckily for him, Tony's too cotton-headed to care.
"Fine."
Tony's hands are tucked into his blanket cocoon, forcing him to toss his head instead.
"Come in. Help me finish the pizza when it gets here."
"Oh, okay." Steve follows Tony into the house. It's difficult to recall details while his brain is like this, which is the other big frustration about being sick. Bad enough that the body fails, why does the mind have to as well? Worse yet, it means he has to waste more time recovering, as if he doesn't have a shit ton of things to do.
"Were you sleeping on the floor of your living room?"
Steve says. "It's my house. I can do what I want. Near to the workshop down here in case I get a..." Tony mimes something hitting his head. "A wham."
"You're sick," Steve says.
Tony turns to snarl at Steve, but is thrown off balance at the discovery that Steve's much closer than expected. He's right there, all how many hundred pounds of beef of him, right in Tony's face and frowning at him. One huge calloused hand lands gently on Tony's forehead, and the coolness of his skin makes Tony gasp.
"Fever," Steve says. "Not my fault."
Tony goes cross-eyed, trying to look at Steve's hand.
"And you're sleeping on the floor?"
Steve says, appalled.
"No, none of that. Where's your bedroom?"
"No constructive criticism. Upstairs and to the left, Captain," Jarvis says.
"You're fired, Jarvis," Tony whines.
"You're fired, and I'm going to sell you to Microsoft."
"You're not going to do that," Steve says patiently. "How about we get you to bed?"
"No, I'm hungry," Tony exclaims. "Pizza's on the way."
"Okay, we can do that too."
Steve puts his hands on Tony's shoulders and steers him to the couch. But before Tony can drop into it, Steve takes the soundly constructed nest of blankets from the floor with a single grab of his large arms.
With military precision, Steve rearranges the lot on the couch with a spot for Tony carved in the middle, which he then points at for Tony to sit. Tony does, then watches in increasing bafflement as Steve swaddles him with another blanket.
"You were here a few days ago," Tony says. "Don't go making house visits a habit now."
"Not unless I'm invited, no," Steve says.
Something feels wrong about that statement. Is it an underlying assumption that Tony would ever invite him again, or that Steve would ever want to be invited?
It's hazy.
Tony grabs at the most obvious point instead.
"You weren't invited this time."
"True, but I'll make up for that."
"By bullying me, I see."
"I'd apologize, but it wouldn't be honest." Tony hack-coughs through a laugh, then falls into silent fascination at Steve's pleased smile. Steve's not even looking at him as he's smiling. He's too busy taking a corner of one of the blankets and wiping the sweat from Tony's brow and neck. It's nice, but Tony's still wigged out. Steve's not supposed to be here. Steve doesn't do this kind of thing. They're not actually friends.
Right?
They can't be. Tony would have noticed.
"Shrapnel," Tony says, apropos of nothing. "In me, not fun."
Steve's done Tony tucking in, so he sits on the coffee table in front of Tony and nods.
"I've read the file."
"Been trying other solutions besides upgrading the arc reactor. Tried a thing with magnets. Got an infection, fever."
"Ah," Steve says sympathetically. "Now you know, and you can try something else."
"Yeah, exactly." Tony feels himself getting groggy again, lulled by layers of blankets. "Why are you here?"
"Oh, it's the... Remember we were supposed to discuss the Avengers dossier, and it's been a while, so I thought..."
"Nope." Tony shakes his head. "That can be an email. Why are you here?" There's definitely a proper answer to be given because Steve's hesitation feels weighty, like a door bolted shut. Tony wants to claw at that door until he gets what he wants, but he's also sleepy and getting sleepier.
"Stay here." Steve rises to his feet. "I'll see to the pizza."
Tony drifts off into groggy, almost sleep. As he does so, he has the sleep-distorted thought about how funny it is that Steve showed up on the same day that Tony finally got a response from BD-01432. When Tony next snaps back to wakefulness, the last thought bumps its way to the forefront of his mind, but it feels less funny, more, weird. It's a coincidence, though. Steve definitely has another legitimate, though likely still stupid, reason for being here, and it has nothing to do with the feverish message Tony sent to BD-01432 earlier this morning. Because the possibility that those two people are one and the same is ridiculously, hilariously small. An intrusive thought chimes in. It's not impossible, though. The living room is quiet, but the front door is open and there's a bottle of ibuprofen and a glass of water on the coffee table. The reason for the open door is revealed when Steve returns through it while balancing pizza boxes on one hand and holding his wallet with the other.
"Ah, you're up," Steve says when he sees that Tony's awake.
He puts the pizza on the coffee table and goes off to the kitchen.
"I'll get some plates."
Tony doesn't reply since he's too busy thinking.
"Sure, okay. Not impossible, but very, very unlikely.
Even narrowing down the internet population to BD-01432's rough location, that's still a massive number to contend with. Even if it does make sense that Steve might have been struggling with the internet in his freshly unfrozen days and mistook a message box for a search bar, what are the chances that he would have messaged one of Tony's throwaway accounts? Tiny. Pathetically tiny. It'd be hilarious if Steve was BD-01432, though. Tony laughs at the mental image. Then he coughs because his throat hates him.
"Do you need water?"
asks Steve, who is suddenly back in Tony's face. He hands over the glass, which gives Tony something to do while his mind keeps whirling. "See... it's a hilarious thought because BD-01432 and Steve Rogers can't be more different from each other. BD-01432 is funny and charming and adorably grumpy and confused about so many things, but insatiable in how much he wants to learn, while Steve is... The point is that Steve is nothing like BD-01432. Because BD-01432 is definitely an old guy. But Steve's literally displaced out of time. And has so much to say. But Tony also finds it easier to communicate anonymously. And he's nice instead of infuriating, and he thinks that Tony's interesting. But Steve's been kind of nice lately, hasn't he? Steve was there at the restaurant that night, of all places, and of all nights. A chill moves up Tony's spine. BD-01432 can't be Steve. It'd be awful if he was, because Tony's been not too fast. Steve's hands touch Tony's, stopping him from chugging all the water down. Jarvis says you haven't taken anything since this morning. We'll get some food in you and then meds, all right? Tony stares while Steve picks through the pizza boxes. His brain supplies the recent memory of how Steve tried to speak to him that night in the restaurant, and Tony kept cutting him off because he was so focused on himself. A sensation not unlike panic seizes Tony's chest. No, no, no. He can't jump to conclusions. It could just be the fever talking. Is this okay? Steve offers him a plate and frowns at the way Tony's staring at him. Tony? Yeah, Tony bleats. If you're not up for it. I'm just hungry. Tony grabs a plate and starts stuffing his face. Steve takes a slice for himself. Tony vaguely registers Steve asking if he can and makes himself comfortable a little further down the couch. There, Steve eats slowly while checking his phone and is blissfully unaware that Tony is having a bout of hysterics in his own head. Please let Steve not be BD-01432. Please let BD-01432 be anyone but Steve, because Tony's only ever wanted to be a good friend to BD-01432. And he can't have already fucked that up before it really took off. BD-01432 came to him while he was hurting, and also Tony hates Steve. Does he, though? It'd be agony if he was Steve, because then he'd know about Tony's fears and anxieties and stupid pleasures and how fucking needy he can be. But BD-01432 shared things with him, too, and turned to him at an emotional low point. Anyway, he can't be Steve. Fact is, whatever Steve thinks of him now, on the night of the dinner, they were most definitely not on good terms. Ergo, it stands to reason that Steve is not BD-01432, because if he was at the restaurant expecting to meet him, he would have hightailed it the moment that he realized that Cherry Red 32 was Tony. Hell, he would have been fucking pissed. Imagine having already lost another good friend on top of the series of losses he'd already gone through, only to discover that the person that he'd turned to for a sympathetic ear was someone he already knew and hated. He wouldn't just ghost Tony. He'd avoid him altogether, erase all evidence of their communication, and he would not come to Tony's house of his own free will to... What are you doing? Tony says. Steve has pulled a first aid kit out of nowhere and rummages inside it until he finds a box. Is this a... Okay, yes, it's a thermometer. Where did you get that? Jarvis, Steve says. Do you want another slice? Tony looks at his empty plate and decides that no, his stomach can't handle another one right now. He shoves the plate at Steve, who calmly puts it on the table and aims the digital thermometer at Tony's forehead. That night, at the restaurant, Steve had a pained expression when he approached Tony's table. Could that face have been one of uncertainty, since he knew he was about to enter an awkward situation? No, that can't be it. Steve looked at him like that simply because he can't stand him. You can't stand me, right? Tony says.
Sure, that's why I'm taking your temperature right now. Steve squints at the digital readout. That's not so bad.
Rogers?
Yes?
I want my phone.
Steve looks around and finds said phone from where it had fallen under the coffee table, and he dutifully hands it over. While Steve then busies himself with the ibuprofen and topping up the glass of water, Tony swipes through his cell phone to pull up BD01432's chat box. He types a response.
I might be in trouble.
What are you going to do about it?
Tony hits send and looks at Steve, hoping for the smoking gun of a notification sound, but there's nothing, not even a telltale vibration from anywhere on Steve's person. Not that that confirms anything either way.
You should probably take this now. Steve hands the bottle over.
Tony's watching him closely. And because he's watching him closely, he sees the way Steve's eyes briefly dart over Tony's phone, very quick, a flick down and away. Is that something? Is it nothing?
Tony takes the ibuprofen, washes it down with water, and gives the glass to Steve to put aside.
Hey, so you remember that guy who stood me up?
Oh?
Is it just Tony's imagination, or does Steve's voice go up in pitch just then? Or is this just another way that BD01432 is making him overthink everything? Because that's totally something BD01432 would do, accidentally or not. The guy has a talent for haunting Tony, even though he's never seen him face to face. And how is that fair? It's not fair at all.
He's a dick, Tony says.
Steve's tidying up the first aid kit, so he's not looking at Tony directly. This, however, allows Tony to study every twitch and line on Steve's ridiculous face, hoping that one of them will cause the answers to spill out. Of course, Tony would be much better at analysis if he weren't fucking sick, but there's nothing he can do about that right now.
I'm glad I never met him, Tony continues, because I'm still so pissed.
I don't think you should be telling me this, Steve says.
Sick man here, let me talk. I have like 3 friends.
Two of them, I pay.
It's still real, I know it is. But that's also a fact.
Rhodey, he's my best friend because he's a stubborn bastard who gave a runt at MIT more time than he deserved.
This guy, though?
Tony waves the phone in his hand.
This one's on me. I earned this. Somehow. I don't know how I did it, but I did. And that made it precious. Yet he threw it away.
There.
A twitch on Steve's face. Is that it? Is that confirmation?
I'm glad it's over, Tony says, voice rising, because he needs to get Steve to fight him. Because now I don't have to waste any more of my time.
The sentence is cut off by a rattling cough, followed by another.
Tony, you're upset.
Steve sounds concerned, but unhurt.
You might feel a little better since you've eaten, but you're still...
I hope I never hear from him again because I'm mad.
Okay, you're mad, but your lungs don't appreciate what you're doing right now.
Steve puts a hand at Tony's chest, a firm weight, just next to the arc reactor. Tony's shocked by the strong, confident touch, and then distracted by Steve's furrow of concentration as he follows the rise and fall of Tony's chest through the next couple of breaths.
Tony, you're shivering, Steve says. You have to go to bed now. Let's go.
Actually, he does feel kind of dizzy.
Shit, I don't want to pass out.
Tony's words come out slightly garbled.
It's okay, I'm here.
Steve helps him stand up and everything goes vague for a little bit. There are steps, some of them up a staircase. He's pretty sure he doesn't swoon, which is good, because he's too out of it to make a face-saving joke about it. By the time it occurs to Tony that he should mutiny against Steve's manhandling him, he's already sitting on his unmade bed, Steve moving around him to pull at the covers while helping him settle in.
I'm so zonked,
Tony mutters.
Sleep sounds good,
Steve suggests.
Yeah.
Tony lies down, is tucked in, and blinks up dazedly into a concerned Steve's face.
We can talk again when you feel better, Steve says.
Okay.
Okay. Tony looks at his ceiling in feverish, nondescript bafflement, and he hears Steve's faint voice out in the hallway asking Jarvis if he can get anyone to check on Tony later.
"I'll make sure of it, Captain," Jarvis replies.
"Thank you," Steve says. There are footsteps, then quiet, and then Tony falls asleep. The next day starts with less fever and more clarity, but it also brings a new message from BD-01432.
"Do you want to try meeting again?"
Tony stares at it. He could wait to reply, but he sends one now with all the immediate honesty he has. "I don't know."
Chapter 9, Tony and Steve. Tony arrives at SHIELD HQ wearing his other battle armor, a pressed suit and dark glasses, both of which he keeps on while he marches through the entrance and takes the elevator up. He's had a few days to get over his fever and finish up his proposal, which contains a few variations in case Fury gets tetchy.
He's kind of hoping that Fury does get tetchy, because that might make it interesting. He is impatient, excited, and trepidatious to see how the day will play out, and this is usually a good state of mind to be in when he wants to be productive. They're expecting him, and he's shown to a fancy conference room where Maria Hill and Steve Rogers are already seated.
"Nice to see you're doing better," Hill says.
"Me too," Tony looks at the table's other occupant. "Hey."
"Hi," Steve says.
"Looking good," Tony almost says, except one, Hill is right there, and two, Steve is wearing the exact same blue and white combat suit that Tony's already seen him in a couple of times and has been itching to improve because the chest and shoulder pieces are awful and restrict movement. The shade of blue is nice, though, and the boots much better than the usual SHIELD issue ones, and Tony can give credit where it's due. Anyway.
"You gonna call Fury or what?" Tony says. "He doesn't have time to spare?"
A side door opens and Fury enters.
"I'm here. Hold your horses. You got something for me?"
"Here's what I figure," Tony starts. "You got this whole list, and you're not interested in everyone here, obviously. So it should be fair game if I want to approach some of your persons of interest."
"I already have a couple of questions," Fury says, "but please continue."
"It goes okay." Tony admits that he's not a great team player, but he's widening his options and genuinely wants to meet some of the people on Fury's list. One Dr. Banner, in particular, towards the top of the pile. Hill's face cycles through multiple expressions that Tony only calls out once. Fury listens and makes vague noises and points out a few truths. A SHIELD admin guy arrives with coffee and snacks. No one yells at each other. Steve only chimes in with a few questions, but otherwise spends most of his time listening.
"Fact is, I don't think you know what the Avengers should look like," Tony says. "You know what they should do and why that's important. But when it came to putting it together, you went with what you already know."
Fury hums.
"Maybe it doesn't even need to be a team," Tony says. "Maybe just connections. People who know someone who knows someone."
"Like a phone tree," Steve says.
"Yeah, maybe like that," Tony says.
"You know what a phone tree is?"
Fury says.
"Internet, so helpful," Steve says.
"Because this whole recruitment thing," Tony pats the folder, "feels a bit gauche. Am I saying that because I failed? Partially, yes. But mainly I'm saying that because I am what the world already has. You don't put me in the game, it doesn't matter, because I am already in it."
Fury slowly sits up and fixes his collar. Hill watches him curiously, seemingly unsure of what he's going to say next.
"You want to know this, Captain?" Fury asks.
Steve starts, surprised at the question.
"What?"
"Stark's going to be networking," Fury says, "meeting new people, seeing what's out there. Sounds like something you might be into."
That sounds like it's a callback to something Fury and Steve have been talking about already, which is intriguing. What's also intriguing is the way that Steve looks at Tony, a quick flash of interest, yet still hesitant.
"I think Tony and I need to talk privately first," Steve says.
"All right," Fury says, shrugging.
The list? Tony prompts.
Yes, go ahead, use it. Fury waves a hand, as if it really is that easy, though the effect is slightly ruined by Hill's amused expression. Unionize, whatever floats your boat. That went so smoothly that Tony wonders if he really needed to come at all. But no, he did. The Avengers are still Fury's brainchild, and he's been doing the legwork for it since the 80s. It just so happens all of that work aligns with Tony's projections of what the world will need moving forward.
So, I can steal your people, Tony says, if it comes to that.
Romanoff's undercover and Barton's in New Mexico, Fury says. Hell, do go after Barton if you want to. Might be something right up your wheelhouse there.
What's that supposed to mean? Tony asks.
I'll forward you the details, Hill says.
And I have somewhere else to be. Fury stands up, prompting everyone else to stand up as well.
He nods at Tony and Steve in turn. Gentlemen, and may I just say that it's a pleasure to see the two of you get along.
No, we don't, Tony says automatically, while Steve says, only sometimes.
Tony turns a bemused scowl at Steve, who merely gazes back at him steadily. Somewhere in the background, Fury and Hill leave the room, and then there's just the two of them. Tony would start fidgeting at this point, but most of his current brain power is devoted to trying to decide if he should sit back down or not. Fact. Steve is still a possible candidate for BD-01432's real-world identity. Another fact. There's been no new messages from BD-01432 after Tony's last reply, where he said that he didn't know whether he wanted to try to meet up again. It's a hanging thread that made Tony second-guess whether he should come to S.H.I.E.L.D. today or not. But the needs of the Iron Man outweigh the needs of the Cherry Red 32, and here he is, alone in a room with Steve, who may or may not be BD-01432. For all of Tony's previous pissing and moaning about not knowing what happened to BD-01432 after the failed meetup, he's not sure if he wants an answer anymore. If Steve is BD-01432, he can swoop in with that revelation at any moment, and Tony hasn't yet figured out how to respond and not have it end with another yelling match. Steve just does things to Tony's head, has from the very first time they met each other, and he's afraid that'll happen again when his brain tries to reconcile him and BD-01432 being the same person, and Tony won't be able to stop himself from saying the worst possible thing. If Steve isn't BD-01432, then there's someone else out there who knows a side of Tony that matters, and about whom Tony wants to get to know better so badly. And what if Tony doesn't have enough space for both? Because Steve is something. He's a person who hasn't written Tony off, despite how they started, and Tony feels, no, he wants, to return that favor properly.
I'm pretty sure, Steve says, breaking the silence, that you don't know what the Avengers need to look like either.
I don't want to lead it, Tony blurts out. Steve blinks in surprise. Maybe he was expecting a deflecting quip, which was certainly Tony's first instinct for a response.
No, he says.
I want to have a say, yes, Tony says, and I'll be bossy as fuck, but I don't want to be top dog. I think that's another thing Fury and Romanoff were afraid about. How do you balance that need for control with the deeply personal unease with authority?
Unease. Steve has the temerity to smile wryly as he says it, too. Okay.
So, is this it? Tony asks. This is the talk you need? You okay with hashing out the details now?
Actually, there's one more thing. Steve bends slightly to pick his satchel off the floor.
There's a subtle theatricality to the way Steve speaks and moves, as though he's a man in a play who's reciting lines off a script. His delivery is measured and even, yet no less genuine. Tony previously thought that that intonation belonged to a man used to being listened to, but now he thinks it more accurately belongs to a man not used to being listened to, but has learned to speak anyway because he should.
I need to,
Steve looks at Tony, and his mouth stretches into a quick, uncomfortable smile. I need to show you this first, before anything else.
Okay.
Tony has no idea what's going on, but withholds his comments while Steve takes out a large folio that has small colorful post-its sticking out from some of its pages. Steve puts the folio flat on the table and casts a look Tony's way. Tony steps in closer and Steve flips it open to one of the marked pages, revealing a pencil drawing of a hefty laptop that's a few years obsolete. Tony's eyes widen. He knows that one. Steve flips to another page on which has been stuck a napkin with cross-hatch pencil drawing that at first glance one would think is abstract art. There are other sketches around it that Tony's never seen before, as if Steve tried to redo the piece on paper but didn't quite get it right, so he had to save the napkin as the original. Curiosity settles over Tony like a warm blanket, and he draws closer to see what Steve's going to show him next. Steve flips the pages. There's a pencil rendition of a burger that's falling apart in its paper container. A charcoal rendition of medieval perpetual machine, a watercolor take of a bicycle stuck in a tree, and all around these familiar drawings are ones that are unfamiliar, which Tony takes in just as eagerly for how they fill the gaps of other things and other places that Steve's seen and Tony hadn't known about. All these images hint at the full life of a real person who gave Tony joy in small, regular bursts of text. Seeing these has Tony reliving all of it in a rush. BD01432's questions, both silly and thought-provoking, his observations on things that Tony usually took for granted, all the follow-up comments and corrections on things Tony told him that showed how he paid attention. It was simple and wonderful, and obviously treasured as much by Steve as it was by Tony. Tony looks up. Steve's face is pale, as though he's on the verge of throwing up. "Where's the one I asked for?" Tony says. Steve blinks. "Oh." He quickly flips to a later page, where there's a beautiful pencil drawing of a winding river with the suggestion of its city around it, though the shading is obscure enough that there are no obvious landmarks. Tony exhales. He knows he's smiling. He can't help it. "That view means something to you?" "From my morning runs," Steve says. "Time I used for myself when it felt claustrophobic, maybe. Help clear my head, at least. It's usually when I'm running that I think of what to write to you next." "Nifty." Tony reaches for the book, but stops himself with a quick glance at Steve, who nods. Permission given, he browses a handful of pages backward, both to admire the scenes and let his fingers linger on pages that Steve touched too. "Today I learned for sure that Tony Stark already knew that I'm the one who's been messaging him," Steve says quietly. "Not no," Tony corrects him. "Guessed. Just guessed. But wasn't sure at all. Uncertainty made a tangled mess in his head. Certainty smooths it out like a map settled flat across a table. BD01432 didn't stand him up. He wanted to meet Tony. He wasn't afraid of who Tony is, just of the unlucky circumstances of how they'd met face to face. He wanted to keep messaging him, but stopped himself for Tony's sake. He wasn't angry at him. He tried to get to know Tony anyway. Emotion swells in Tony's chest. He gasps, too overwhelmed to speak, and flings his arms around Steve for a hug. Just this once, relief overrides awkwardness. Steve in the flesh may still be somewhat of a stranger, but BD01432 is Tony's friend, and he's here. "I missed you," Tony blurts out. Steve inhales sharply. "Oh." His hands come to Tony's back in an awkward pat, but then they stay there. "I missed you, too." "Yeah?" Tony pulls back and looks up at Steve, intending to frown, but completely failing at it. He thinks back on Steve trying to talk to him, reaching out, and trying to make himself approachable. "Thank you for not giving up." "You didn't give up," Steve exclaims. "When you thought I didn't show at the dinner, you were so worried and kept trying to contact me." "What are you talking about?" Tony says, laughing breathlessly. "As soon as you knew who I was, you could have just pretended none of it ever happened. But you kept trying to be friends. Holy shit."
You must have been pissed when you saw me at the restaurant.
Come on, Tony, Steve says, grinning now, as if you wouldn't have been pissed to learn it was me right then and there.
I'll have you know that I was already pissed to see you there, period. No further information needed.
Tony realizes that he's still standing in the circle of Steve's arms and should probably untangle himself, but he can't bring himself to do it. BD-01432 has always been a real person, but now he's even realer. And everything that's been churning inside of Tony now bursts out. I'm sorry about your friend. I wanted to do something, but... It's fine. Thank you, Steve says. I've had time to process.
You're fine, Tony echoes dryly. He's clinging onto Steve's forearms now, and he has a second to feel self-conscious about it until he actually looks into Steve's eyes and sees that same hesitation, the one Tony's been reading off of him for a while now, and is starting to understand that it may have more to do with how different it is to communicate through text versus out loud. Tony understands that, too, doesn't he? It's the same worry he had when wondering if it was a good idea to meet his friend in person. He wanted to give BD-01432 a huge hug, too. Steve, being an awkward, tall drink of water who doesn't seem to know what to do with his hands, just encourages Tony's contrarian side. So Tony gives Steve another one, squeezing tight until Steve's huffing a laugh against the side of Tony's head.
I forgot, Tony says, voice muffled against Steve's shoulder. I planned to give this to you when I met you. It sounded like you needed one. Yes, Steve says slowly, relief in his voice. Yeah, I think I needed one.
What have you been up to?
Tony starts to draw back again, but this time he's also looking up, eager as he is to just look at Steve's face and let it sink in who this guy is. This results in them both looking at each other. When there's mere inches between their faces, their gaze is locking in mutual surprised recognition. Tony didn't imagine it. That's the same face Steve made in the workshop, as though he hadn't expected his response to Tony's proximity any more than Tony did the other way around.
Oh, okay,
Tony says quietly. Steve says. Tony kisses him, not directly on the mouth, but slightly to the side, as if to give them both the flimsiest of plausible deniability. But Steve turns his face into it, a deliberate motion that is incandescently hot, and causes their mouths to brush together. It's electric. Tony is so startled by his reaction that he hangs there for a second, not quite processing what's happening, and then his brain parses kiss with Steve, which feels nice. Tony pushes, Steve gives, and their mouths slot together gently. It's soft and careful and grows deeper as it goes on. It feels like the most natural thing in the world, and a hopeful indication that everything that happened between them before doesn't have to be a mistake if it brought them to this. Steve keeps huffing surprised breaths against Tony's mouth between kisses, to which Tony would say, ditto. The want that rises in Tony feels new, but at the same time, as though it's slotting into a place that Tony hadn't known he'd been nurturing all this while. Finding BD-01432's word sexy is one thing, acknowledging that Steve Rogers is attractive is another thing, but this is something else. The layers of who they are and have been to each other no longer feel scary but intriguing, as if Tony has a brand new project thrown into his lap. He and Steve could spend as much time as they want, untangling it all. They part, mostly to catch their breath, and in doing so, they look at each other. It's hard to say who starts laughing first. Tony, probably, though it's close.
Wasn't expecting that, Tony says.
Wasn't expecting you. Everything about you.
Steve turns his face to the side, drawing Tony's attention back to the sketchbook. This time, Steve deftly moves to a page that isn't marked with a post-it. This page has a pencil drawing of a pair of dark eyes without a face, where said eyes are long-lashed, turning downward, shadowed with emotion.
Me? Tony says, that's me.
Kept thinking about that night.
Steve pushes a wayward strand of hair from Tony's forehead, making Tony's skin tingle.
Thought I must have gotten it wrong.
that it was just coincidence that you were there and also had an hourglass on your table, went through your messages trying to make sense of it, and by the time I had to admit that you were cherry red, I felt I'd missed the window. Hey, now. The last thing you expected or needed that night was another fight. Steve makes a face and Tony shakes his head. It's fine. Oh, so that's fine too, is it? Steve counters. What? No, it's not the same thing. You've been working so hard all this time to catch up, to fill in the gaps most people don't even realize are gaps. What about you? You put yourself out there when you know how risky it is. And I have no idea how you had the patience to put up with all of my...
Please. You get me started on something I'm into. You have to work to get me to shut up.
Tony. Steve puts his hands on Tony's face. He's also scowling in a pitiful attempt to be solemn. But he can't stop smiling any more than Tony can. Do you want to get lunch? I can take you to one of my regular places.
Yes, Tony says. Big yes, biggest yes. I want to see it. I want to see everything you've...
He gasps when he remembers and shoves at Steve playfully. I am bereft of your regular updates, I'll have you know. What have you been doing all this time?
Well, Steve says thoughtfully, I've been trying to get to know this guy that I got wrong the first time round. Seems to be going well.
Second time round. Tony plucks his phone from his back pocket and waves it at Steve.
We got it the first time round, okay, I think.
Oh, I like that, Steve says, pleased.
Right.
The temptation to kiss Steve again rears its head. But that has to wait. For now, Tony grabs the rest of his things, and Steve follows suit. We better go, Tony says, before Hill asks one of her underlings to kick us out.
I don't mind,
Steve says, making Tony double-take in surprise. But you're right. It would be more polite to go. Mr. B.D. Number is also a cheeky bastard, I see. Tony blinks. Brooklyn Dodgers? That's right, Steve says. The Iron Man suit is not cherry red, by the way. I know it's not. Tony hooks his hand into Steve's elbow and pulls him along for the door.
That username's a reference to something else, which you don't get to know about until we're a couple of dates deep.
Oh. The end.